Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I've lost a lot of sleep to dream.
Insomniac, bad dreams got me losing sleep.
And now we'll tackle sleep. Like you've been, if you've been waking up in the middle of the night with feelings of anxiety, and why getting enough sunlight during the day, even if you're living a mostly stay-at-home lifestyle, might be a key to falling asleep faster. Joining me now to break this down and more is Dr. Charlene Gamaldo, MD, Medical Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Sleep at Howard County General Hospital. Dr. Gamaldo, thanks for some time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
I saw that the word insomnia was Googled more in 2020 than it had ever been before, according to a recent article on the BBC website. How do feelings like stress, anxiety, and isolation actually impact our sleep?
So that's a great question. And yes, so all of us will have what we call our insomnia symptoms every now and then, where you have a difficult time falling asleep or staying asleep due to just the typical woes of life. We've reached a whole new level of that with, of course, the pandemic. And we really consider insomnia to be an official condition once it becomes a problem at least three times a week and for at least 3 months straight, and causes problems with daytime functioning. Once you hit that level, it becomes an issue to be addressed.
We've seen, we've talked on this show before about how alcohol sales have been high during the pandemic. Is it a fact or is it a myth that drinking in the evening might interrupt your sleep in the middle of the night?
It's an absolute fact. And where it becomes a bit of a tumor is that, you know, we know the word nightcap. And that's the idea that, you know, people will drink some alcohol and that'll help them to fall asleep. The issue is that, yes, it may do that, but it also quickly during the night breaks down and then forces people to wake up and what we call a rebound insomnia. So that's the reason why if you're having problems falling asleep, alcohol is not really the way to achieve it.
Do sunlight or exercise, two things that maybe people are getting less of if they're in the staying at home mode, affect sleep?
So sunlight and exercise are wonderful things to bring into your armamentarium to be a better sleeper. And unlike alcohol, they really provide only good things. The difference is, though, and I guess similar to alcohol, it's about the timing of it. So sunlight is great to be exposed to in the morning to sort of set your wake clock so that ideally the clock will then 13 to 14 hours later know it's time to go to sleep. So it helps to sort of schedule things. Exercise is a great promoter in terms of waking you up and also helping to boost your sleep drive later at night. The problem becomes you don't want to get either one of those things too close to bedtime because it gives the brain a mixed signal. Should I be asleep or should I be awake right now? So you really want to do it earlier during the day.
How about stretching, things like that, that aren't, you know, really active cardio, get your metabolism going exercise? But I actually stretch before bed sometimes, and I think it helps me go to sleep.
Sure, that's a great question. Stretching is actually a very good thing to do, and it really brings in the whole idea of also relaxation. So if your muscles are tense, being able to stretch and hopefully iron out those kinks is really going to put you in a physical and mental mode to transition to sleep. One thing you may want to add to that regimen is if you do some vigorous stretching, you may want to drink a little bit of water to go with it so that you can flush out any of the lactic acid or some of the things that may have built up in those previously tense muscles.
Is there a different set of techniques that you advise people on if they have trouble falling asleep at first compared to if they wake up in the middle of the night and then they start thinking about things?
There are some similar techniques and things that are a tad different. So if you, in terms of priming yourself for your best capability of transitioning into sleep, and it really should be within 30 minutes. So anything within 30 minutes is considered normal. You want to, again, do everything during the day that's going to make you primed with exercise, sunlight exposure, healthy diet during the day to hopefully initiate sleep at bedtime. And then surrounding bedtime, you should have a routine of, again, relaxing if you want to do stretching, those sorts of things, and then limiting light exposure and certainly any sort of content, whether it's on the radio or the TV, that may be emotionally charged. If you wake up in the middle of the night, you give yourself about a 30-minute buffer to see if you can fall back to sleep. And if not, then you should go to another room and do engage in relaxing things until you feel you're ready to go to sleep again. Try again, and then you go back to the bedroom and start over. And then basically it's just a, you know, wash, rinse, repeat as the way to hopefully get you ideally in a mode to initiate, maintain sleep within a 30-minute time period.
All right, 30 seconds left. Under what circumstances, if ever, do you recommend sleep aids, be it, you know, the more natural melatonin type things or prescription ones?
So of the sleep aids available, I would recommend melatonin first. Keep in mind that in most cases over the counter, it's considered an unregulated supplement. So know that there could be quite a bit of variability from brand to brand or even pill to pill. At that point, if that has not worked, I really would consult your doctor regarding any of the other over-the-counter medications, much less any of the prescription medications, because any of them can have side effects and you really need to individualize it for the patient.
Dr. Charlene Gamaldo, Medical Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Sleep at Howard County General Hospital. Thank you so much. This has really been very informative.
First order of business when it comes to the black female. First time, last time. I think I said this before on this program. I've certainly said it on many others. What do I mean by first time, last time? First time he hits you. That's the last time.
But we begin this podcast with a shocking statistic from the World Health Organization. One in three women has suffered violence at some point in their life, usually at the hands of their partner. And the head of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, says the coronavirus pandemic is likely to have made matters worse. This woman suffered for many years before finding refuge at a shelter with her two young children.
It was very, very bad during lockdown because I was pregnant as well. And it was really hard, really, really bad. The amount of verbal abuse I got, you are not a good mother, you are dumb, you know, you never achieve anything in this life. I'll be hit and kicked sometimes, and I'm pregnant. January this year, I had already given birth to my son, and I was recovering because I went through a cesarean section. And one day, I don't know what he was arguing about, and I was just quiet, and he pushed me, and I almost fell on the radiator. And that's the moment I realized that this person does not care, and this person will do anything to see me hurt. And I thought, really, this person will kill me one day.
A woman here in the UK. I heard more about the WHO's report from our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folkes.
They looked at 161 countries. They take data from those countries. There's a bit of a hazard for warning for you, because we know, don't we, that a lot of women don't report violence, particularly sexual violence. So although these figures are horrifying, one in three women have experienced violence in their lifetimes, it is quite likely to be higher than that.
And is it worse in some parts of the world than others?
Some parts of the world show higher levels. But, you know, let's not be complacent anywhere that we are, because this is, and I think the WHO has really used the right word here, pervasive. It is everywhere. Every country on the planet, women experience violence and sexual violence. Depressingly, most often from their partners. So we have, for example, if you look at South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Oceania, we have levels of partner violence between 30 and 50%.
Europe, so what, nearly half of women in some of those areas have experienced violence at the hands of their partner?
That's right. Europe, 20%. That's one in five. That's still really bad.
I mean, those are extraordinary figures. Is there anything that can be done that the WHO identifies?
Underpinning it all is societal change. That's what the WHO says. It has to start with gender equality. And gender equality also implies respect. You respect women to earn the same as men. You respect them to have the same chances in life, in jobs, in education. And until you change that, and we know, don't we, it's a huge, huge ask, because every country is struggling with gender equality, this kind of thing is going to persist. At the same time, the WHO also talks about having the conversation within communities, outreach, ensuring that there is support for women who are experiencing violence, particularly in the home, in a relationship, that they should know there is somewhere to go to where they can talk and where they can feel safe if they need to. Now, sadly, all of these statistics from the WHO were before the pandemic. They go up to 2018. And what is expected is that these statistics will actually get worse once we've crunched the numbers from what actually happened during the pandemic, with school closures, with lockdowns, with people penned up at home.
Imogen Folkes.
That there was no such place. I had a vague idea that Rio de Janeiro was a place, so I kind of kept that in the back of my mind in reserve. And if all these other places fail, I could probably wind up, join the Navy or something, and go to Rio, and I could escape for a few minutes from being black. And a lot of black people thought that way in the back of their minds. They were looking for a place. That's the gist of what I'm saying. But the racists, this thing called white supremacy, over a period of years, about 1957, while I was in Japan, I began to realize that you got to turn around and just grab it. It's no place to run.
The governor of Brazil's most populous state, Sao Paulo, has announced tough restrictions in response to the country recording its highest number of COVID-19-related deaths, more than 2,000 in a single day. From Monday, there'll be an overnight curfew from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. All religious and sporting events will be suspended. The state governor, João Doria, said beaches and parks will also be closed. Brazil has recorded the second highest number of deaths with the virus in the world after the United States. Our South America correspondent, Katie Watson, reports from Sao Paulo.
Every few days, a worrying new record is being broken. Intensive care units across the country are filling up. People are dying while they wait in line for beds. And the fear is that Brazil's new variant is making matters worse. At the same time, just 4% of Brazilians have been given their first vaccine. Experts have criticised the federal government for its slow response in keeping people safe. Dr. Natalia Pasternak is a microbiologist.
Brazil runs the risk of becoming a virus incubator and a mutation incubator, because if you have one country this big with the virus running wild, the probability of more variants emerging is really big. And if we don't vaccinate and we don't take really serious preventive measures as lockdowns, the virus will continue to run wild. So Brazil runs the risk of becoming an international pariah.
But President Jair Bolsonaro continues to rail against locking down the country. Last week, he told people to stop whining and fussing. Instead, it's governors who are introducing restrictions to curb the spread of the virus. Earlier this week, former President Lula da Silva didn't hold back either, telling people to ignore the president and the health minister and get vaccinated. This country, he said, didn't have a government. Indeed, there's growing fear that with no national leadership, this crisis is only going to get worse.
Katie Watson in Brazil.
That's right. We move it to Mississippi, and you know how that's spelled. M-I, crooked letter, I. Crooked letter, I. Hump back, I.
It's been nearly a month since a deep freeze hit parts of the South, knocking out power and water in Texas, Mississippi, and elsewhere. But in Jackson, Mississippi, the largest city in the state, water service is still not totally reliable. John Yang has the details.
Judy, much of Mississippi's largest city is beginning its fourth week without safe drinking water coming out of faucets. Jackson residents, about 80% of whom are Black, remain under a system-wide order to boil water, and some don't have any running water at all. Joanne Moore lives in South Jackson.
We're just taking it day by day. That's all we can do until we get full restoration of our water. It's been hard, but we've been dealing with it, you know, but the infrastructure is just so old.
Since a mid-February winter storm, the city has had about 80 water main breaks. Chokwe Anta-Lumumba is the mayor of Jackson. He joins us now. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much. Tell us, what is the situation right now as we speak? And give us some idea of what life has been like for your residents for the past 3 weeks.
You know, life has been quite difficult for our residents. As you can imagine, it not only has limited people's ability to drink water and to eat food and cook with water, but to bathe. And we have to remember that we are in the midst of a pandemic, so it becomes all the more alarming to not have water for all the hygienic recommendations that we have laid out in the midst of this pandemic in almost every conceivable way. Where we are today, fortunately, we can report that we are towards the end of our journey. We have somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 500 residents that are still without water, and the majority of those have low water pressure. And that might be on account of a myriad of issues, breaks that have happened in their homes, issues with the water meter. And so we are quickly moving to bring that number down. We won't be satisfied until the very last resident has their water restored.
You've talked to both state and federal officials about help, to sort of repair the system and bring the system up to date. What's been the response?
Well, fortunately, we've been able to gain audience with the leadership in the state house. Some members of the federal family, like representation from the EPA, have reached out and expressed their desire to be supportive of the city of Jackson. So we have made certain that we put in our estimated damages from the recent crisis that we suffered, and we hope that the state, the county, and through the state issues that to the federal government, and we're hopeful, we're optimistic that we'll be able to get the support that we need in order to address this most recent crisis. Jackson's infrastructure is in a dire state. It is an aged legacy city where one of our plants is literally more than 100 years old. Another one is outdated, and so we are in need of several repairs because we face more extreme weather conditions today. We have hotter summers, colder winters, and more rain in the rainy season.
In the past couple of weeks, the governor and the lieutenant governor have both sort of made remarks about the city, about the city's ability to collect water bills and keep up its infrastructure. And the lieutenant governor even talked about, said that the last time work had been done was under a mayor who happened to have been the last white mayor of Jackson. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing that's not often talked about but is a reality is that there are equity questions in terms of how infrastructure is supported, in terms of how cities are supported. And we need to be able to build equitable models of what it means to build and support cities. In fact, as we look at the success of our state economy, it should be more based on a dignity economy, which expresses the inherent dignity of every community, and not look so based on issues of race. It is not surprising. You know, it has been the history of the city of Jackson to not have support, which is commensurate with the support that the city of Jackson provides to the state of Mississippi. What I mean by that is that we're the largest city by a factor of three, meaning we provide the overwhelming contribution to the state's taxes. We are the capital city, which means that many of our properties are not taxable, and we provide services to the state, such as give them water with no payment for water bills. Where other cities, other capital cities in the nation get payment in lieu of taxes, we don't receive that. And so these are questions that have needed to be answered for a long time. So most certainly, city leadership has a responsibility to make certain that we're in a better place than in which we receive the city. The state has a responsibility as well. And we will never solve a problem with the same level of thinking that created it. It is that type of thinking that created the problem in the first place.
Jackson Mayor Chokwe Antai-Lumumba, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi-ho, the Dario, the farmer in the dell.
For generations, the U.S. government has provided financial help to farmers, as long as those farmers were white. Black, Latino, and indigenous farmers have been excluded from loans and other government programs, and that discrimination has steadily squeezed people of color out of the business. The coronavirus relief bill that the House approved today includes $5 billion to address that problem. And Congressman David Scott of Georgia joins us to talk about it. He's a Democrat and chair of the House Agriculture Committee. Chairman Scott, good to have you here.
Oh, it's great being with you, Ari.
We are talking about more than a century of discrimination and exclusion. Back in 2004, we talked to a black farmer in Alabama named Lukata Mjumbe. He's former director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. And here's what he told us.
I never met a farmer in all of the different states in the southern United States that I worked in, a black farmer that had not been discriminated against by USDA.
And the number of black farmers in America has shrunk from almost a million a century ago to under 50,000 today. So how much can this measure really do?
Let me just say that this is just merely a down payment compared to what we are going to do to address the past discrimination, the current discrimination of black farmers. Folks have got to understand this is no preferential treatment. This is no reparation. This is business. It is business that has been long overdue. Nobody has paid the dues for farming and agriculture like African American people. We were the pioneers in agriculture, in slavery, under the lash of the whip. I was born on a farm in Aynor, South Carolina, my grandfather's, where I picked the cotton, cropped the tobacco, milked the cows, plowed the field, all of that. My grandfather got that farm in the 30s. And back during that period, 18.9% of all the farms in the South were owned by black farmers. You know what it is today? Less than 2%.
And so you call this a down payment. What specifically do you expect to be able to do with that down payment of $5 billion?
Is to open our eyes to what else we must do. When I say down payment, it's a down payment on what we are going to do and provide on March the 25th, when I will be bringing in our Black farmers for the very first time to have a hearing before Congress.
So if we could talk about some of the specific provisions, there's $4 billion here for debt relief for minority farmers, another $1 billion for assistance, which includes inheritance and property issues, and also a racial equity commission to root out discrimination at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Do you think that discrimination is still endemic at USDA? There's certainly been evidence of it in the past. Is it there in the present?
I have no idea. That's why I'm trying to tell you I'm having the hearing to find out. You can't move in a direction to solve a problem unless you get the proper intelligence, unless we bring in Vilsack.
This is Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Agriculture Secretary. So that's why I'm trying to move in an orderly fashion.
Now, as you know, Republicans who oppose this have said, first, it's not directly related to COVID relief. And second, they argue it's unconstitutional to hand out money based on race. How do you respond to that?
Because we are moving to correct a massive wrong. Where were the cries from the Republicans when the racial discrimination was put? Yes, it is constitutional. We have based the constitutionality on the basic principle that Jefferson laid out. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. This was designed to correct discrimination against African Americans.
Congressman David Scott of Georgia is a Democrat and chair of the House Agriculture Committee. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Harry, for having me.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this? A lot of
it comes
people say
from
it's
China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all. No, not at all. It comes from China.
It's been a year since the pandemic changed life as we know it, not least for Asian Americans. In many cities, they've been the target of racists who blame them for the coronavirus. New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco have all reported a rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. Harder to track are other incidents beyond crime that cast a cloud of discrimination. Connie Chung Jo is CEO of a legal aid group, Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles. Connie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
Where you are in LA, there have been high-profile hate incidents in recent weeks. What's happening?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, we had an Air Force veteran who was physically assaulted and had his nose fractured and was called all sorts of racial slurs. And we've been seeing across the country over the last year, over 3,000 reported incidents of hate like that against the Asian community.
Who is most affected? Is there a way to measure that?
So we are seeing some patterns. First, out of the 3,000 reported cases, almost half of them are coming from California. Another thing is that women are targeted more than twice as often as men. And then we are seeing a spate of hate and violence targeted at our seniors. The focus of some of these attacks are people who are considered to be less able to stand up for themselves.
What's the effect of that for Asian Americans right now?
Well, I will say it's a scary time for our community. Folks are incredibly disturbed and worried about what's happening. Many of the folks that I speak to are scared to go out, or they're encouraging their elderly parents not to go out of the house, even for things like daily walks or trips to the grocery store. So folks are really worried about this. And there's also a lot of outrage of why is this still allowed to happen in our society?
What's the reporting like? Do you trust that the data is actually capturing the number of incidents that are happening?
Well, so the 3,000 reported incidents I mentioned are just the tip of the iceberg. When you think about the vulnerable community members, we're talking about folks who are seniors, often limited English speaking, and they don't know how to navigate language and cultural barriers. And so there's far more people who have not reported incidents than those who have.
I mean, when you think about whether or not these attacks are underreported, does it have anything to do with representation in the police force? Does that make a difference here at all?
Well, I don't think we have a great deal of Asian representation in the police force. And I mean, I think it can certainly help if there were. But I think part of what we've seen is that law enforcement has not done enough to recognize and investigate and report on these hate-based incidents. And unfortunately, some victims told me that when they called the police said, well, there's nothing we can really do here. And I think if the community feels that the police aren't going to do anything, then chances are that word gets around and the community feels next time I'm not going to report it, then what's the point?
Connie Chung-Jo, CEO of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now that the snow is cleared, also in Plano, Texas, a teen was forced to drink urine at a slumber party. Only black teen there. And he was called the N-word, nigger, shot with a BB gun, all of these things. And they're still investigating. Like, they're investigating this. They need to investigate further.
An investigation is now underway in Texas after disturbing allegations of bullying and abuse against a middle schooler. After the mother of 13-year-old Samarion Humphrey says her son endured being slapped, shot at with BB guns, and even forced to drink urine by former teammates of his football team during a sleepover. Joining us now is Samarion, his mother, Summer Smith, along with her attorney, Kim T. Cole. Thank you all for being here. Samarion, I'd like to start with you. How are you doing, and how did you end up going to that sleepover?
I'm doing better. I love the support and stuff. So when it came to it, one of the boys, he invited me over during lunch, and I asked my mom, and she was kind of skeptical at first, but then I just begged her for an entire week, and then I guess she talked to the dad. And we thought it was a good idea, so.
And are these people who had bullied you before, or you thought that they were friends?
Can I cut in on this? Is that okay?
Of course.
Okay, so what it is we're talking about five different people, right? So there was only one that was his friend that he was thinking was his friend. Him and this friend had been over, you know, several times, weeks leading up. It wasn't, you know, they were football together previous 2 years about. And then he's never had any problems with that particular guy. That particular guy has been nice to him, befriending him, played the game. Like, so he had no other knowledge of the three boys that had previously bullied him coming to that party on that Saturday.
As a mom, how do you feel that your son is doing, and what have the last few weeks been like for him?
The last few weeks have been absolutely horrible. Absolutely horrible. He thought that this person was his friend. He trusted him. He told me with his own mouth that he didn't know how to feel. He was disappointed. He couldn't believe what had happened. And I honestly believe he's still processing it all, because ever since, you know, Tuesday, the story just kind of took off, and we haven't even had time to figure things out or have like the tough conversations that we need to have, because everything happens so fast. But the love and support and that everyone has showed him during this time has made a huge difference. I will say that.
And Samarion, I'd like to ask you in your own words, if you're able to kind of walk us through what happened that night. You think that you're going to a friend's house for a sleepover, and then what?
And then these boys, they came over without my knowledge. And then one of them, who I thought was my friend, reassured me that
it was all going to be okay, that we had no hard feelings, but I knew that something was going to go down because of the type of people that those boys were. They are not good people. And then, so we were playing video games, and then we go outside. Now, that's when somebody's idea to have, like, I guess to all get shot at. So they all started shooting at me. I didn't have a BB gun at this time. They all started shooting me. And then one shot me in my privates. And then they just pelted me all over my body. And then I just felt so, I was hurting. And then we go back home. And then I was tired, so I went to bed. And then I went to bed. And then throughout my entire sleeping, or slept, they were assaulting me by hitting me and slapping me. And then one of the boys, they woke me up. And then he told me that I wasn't breathing and that I needed to drink this water. And now I have a hard time going to sleep in the first place. So I was very dazed and I didn't know what was going on. But they all urinated into a cup and then they made me drink it.
At any point, were you able to get a parent or were you able to call home and say that you wanted to leave?
I was asleep. I did not know any of this even happened until multiple days after.
And Kim, what kind of actions could potentially be taken against these minors who allegedly did these things to Samarion or against any adults who might have known what was going on?
We certainly hope that the appropriate criminal charges be filed in this action. It's being characterized as bullying, but this far exceeds bullying. What these young men did was criminal. This was assault. They shot at him with a BB gun and they slapped him and then forced him to drink urine. This is not bullying. This is assault. And they should be charged appropriately. And also what Samarion did not mention, that they were calling him racial slurs the entire time. So this rises to the level of a hate crime. So we would like to see charges brought against all of the young men who assaulted him, as well as the parents who allowed this to happen in their home.
So you believe that this was racially motivated?
Absolutely.
And Summer, you're currently trying to raise funds for your son's therapy. What are some of the mental health issues that he's been displaying since the night of that sleepover?
The mental health issues started before the sleepover. So we were already trying to get him into a better place. And so that literally just took it all the way back.
And Kim, have you been in contact with the school district? And if so, what are they saying?
The school district has taken the position that because this particular event occurred off campus, they've taken a hands-off approach to it. However, Samarion's psychological abuse happened on campus. Much of it happened on campus prior to this incident. And so he was already not in a good place when this horrific assault happened. And that happened on campus. There is documentation of him experiencing some bullying and assault on campus.
Well,
and Plano ISD has failed to act.
Samarion, we are certainly sad that you had to endure this. We thank you so much for your time and for sharing your story with us. Thank you all. Samarion, Summer, and Kim.
Thank you.
Mr. Nigga. Nigga, nigga. Nigga, nigga. Nigga. You can laugh and criticize Michael Jackson if you wanna. Woody Allen molested and married his stepdaughter. Same press kicking dirt on Michael's name. Show Woody and Soon Yee at the playoff game.
Hold a hand.
Sit back and just think about that. Would he get that type of dap if his name was Woody Black? OJ found innocent by jury of his peers. And they been fucking with that nigga for the last 5 years.
While the investigation continued in Connecticut, the investigation in New York by the Child Welfare Administration was also underway. The supervisor assigned to the case was Cheryl Hardin.
In my sex abuse unit, I was a senior supervisor.
We investigated child abuse throughout the five boroughs of the city of New York. So after I read the allegations and I looked at it, I said, okay, I'll assign this to Paul. Paul Williams was one of the top investigators that I had. He was very thorough. He was objective.
Paul Williams had roughly handled about 800 cases at the time. And just the year before, in 1991, the city of New York awarded him Caseworker of the Year. It was the first time that they had ever awarded such an award to a caseworker.
Paul interviewed Dylan and found her to be quite credible. At her age, she should not know anything about inserting a finger into the vagina. She should not know anything about inserting a finger into the anus. Those are not things that should be easy for her to discuss unless there's something occurring.
Among the records we obtained were a complete set of Paul Williams' contemporaneous investigation notes. Within the first 2 weeks of being assigned to the case, Williams reported that there was sufficient information to open a criminal investigation of Woody Allen in the state of New York. He was later told by superiors that, in high-profile cases, it is customary for the bigwigs to take over and we do nothing.
This was no ordinary case. Filings were misfiled. Misinformation was put into the computer. There was clearly a strong political climate to shut this thing down. But Paul Williams, his agenda was the best interests of the child. The city of New York had another agenda. They needed to suffocate and silence Paul Williams. And when he wouldn't shut up, they fired him.
Under what pretext?
That he was insubordinate. He wasn't following instructions.
I have no comment to say, okay?
Paul Williams may not want to answer our questions, but his attorney assures us he is not running away from an investigation into whether someone may have intervened in New York City's handling of the child abuse allegations against Woody Allen.
I did my job and I believe the kid, okay?
You believe the kid?
Yes. I have seen no evidence to lead me to believe otherwise. I have nothing further.
Confidential notes obtained from the Human Resources Administration indicate that the investigator attributed the decision not to pursue the case to the mayor's office, a charge they deny.
This wasn't about one supervisor or one department in this agency. This was a massive cover-up attempt, and Paul was caught in the middle.
Williams is suing the city, charging that the mayor's office hid and suppressed information in the case. Williams contends that higher-ups muzzled him, refusing to allow him to report his findings either to New York Family Court or to authorities in Connecticut, where a parallel investigation is still going on.
Every procedure, every rule, every regulation, every statute, every ordinance respecting investigation of a child sexual abuse in this matter was violated.
Women's rights activist Gloria Steinem came to lend her support to Paul Williams.
Someone who knew the case got in touch with me as a reporter, as a journalist. So I talked to Paul. He seemed to me a very admirable, smart, empathetic person with no possible motive to do anything but do his best to find out the truth.
The determination that the judge made was that he shouldn't have been fired, and he was awarded his job back and back pay for what was taken from him. Paul Williams felt vindicated in the individual sense of what happened in terms of getting his job back, but he was never able to complete the very job he was given.
Paul Williams still works for New York City's Administration for Children's Services, and a spokesperson from the agency declined our request for an interview. But in looking through his old case files, we were surprised to see a familiar name. Williams had corresponded directly with Jennifer Sawyer, one of the social workers who had interviewed Dylan for the Yale New Haven investigation in Connecticut. According to Williams' notes, Sawyer had told him that she had not only considered Dylan credible, but believed that she had more to disclose. Sawyer's notes were later destroyed.
In the end, the result was that people with power were able to get the case removed. It just seemed to me, from everything I could glean as a reporter, to be a case of great injustice.
I don't sleep at night. What I do is lay awake thinking about how horrendous this entire matter has been, what they've done to her.
The elite can do whatever they need to do, whatever they want to do, and there's no consequences for it. Not long after that, I think maybe a year later, I left the city agency completely.
Why?
Because I could not continue to do what I did to those low-income families, those black families and welfare families, and have them treated differently than if they would have been a Woody Allen.
There's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism can't solve.
A lot of black Americans are skeptical about taking any of the coronavirus vaccines. It's a sentiment that's been captured by several polls and reflected in interviews for the NPR podcast Code Switch.
I'm hesitant to take the COVID-19 vaccine because of the way the medical industry has treated black people since the start of this country.
My wife has described me as vaccine hesitant. I can't really argue with that, although I tend to think of it as more of an acute lack of enthusiasm.
I will absolutely not get the COVID vaccine.
One factor often cited for that mistrust, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, one of the most infamous medical studies in U.S. history. Our colleagues at Code Switch examined the long shadow of Tuskegee and also pushed back on this idea that this is the main cause of this reluctance by many black people to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Gene Demby is one of the co-hosts of Code Switch. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So let's start by reminding people what exactly the study was.
Yeah, so the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, the full name was the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the African-American Male. It began in 1932, and it was carried out by the federal agency that would be a precursor to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that we have today. And one rationale for the study was that they wanted to see how the disease progressed over time in black people differently. We spoke to Reverend Roosevelt Balms, who was raised by his grandfather near Tuskegee. His grandfather was actually one of the men who was unknowingly part of this experiment. And he would have these occasional checkups with doctors working with the government.
He was thinking that he was getting health care. In other words, they told him that if anything happened, he told them that they had bad blood.
So these doctors would give the men that they were poking and prodding, you know, placebos and occasionally some, you know, mild medications like aspirin, but they avoided any treatment that would slow the disease. And remember, you know, this is the rural South in the Jim Crow period. So this is often the only medical care that these men were getting.
I mean, there's a lot of enraging details about this study, but
yes,
one of
absolutely.
Them, I mean, syphilis had been around a long time. Its symptoms
a very
were,
long time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Not much was there to be learned about this. And we knew at that point that it was serious. If untreated, it can cause blindness, deafness, dementia, and eventually even death.
Yeah, I mean, about a decade into the study, penicillin had pretty much emerged as the most common therapy for this disease. So there was treatment out there for them. So many of these men, they were going to pass it on to their wives or their partners. And because syphilis can be congenital, they would pass it on to their children, too. So when the study was finally exposed in 1972, it became a national scandal. Reverend Balms told us that when it all blew up, that was when he found out about the study for the first time. And his family only found out that his grandfather was one of the people involved as a subject a little bit later when the government gave his grandfather a settlement.
I couldn't imagine learning about that as an adult for one of my family members.
Yeah, it's a horrible, horrible story all the way around.
So you're talking to Reverend Balms in the context of mistrust over the COVID vaccine. I was listening to this episode, and I'm waiting for him to say, and there's no way I'm taking this vaccine.
Right. But that's, you know, not what he told us at all. He said he was absolutely getting the shot.
I'd rather have the shot than wait and see whether I'm going to fall dead.
Yeah, and then you kept exploring this and did some reporting that maybe Tuskegee is an overblown reason for this hesitancy among black people.
Yeah, this was a little surprising to us, but I guess it makes sense. We spoke to Harriet Washington. She studies the history of medical ethics, and she wrote the book Medical Apartheid. So one of the first things we asked her was, should we talk more about this long shadow of Tuskegee as, you know, as a driver for some of this elevated hesitancy among Black people?
No, because it's the wrong question.
You know, the history of medical experimentation on Black people stretches back farther and much wider than Tuskegee. There were all kinds of horrible experiments, you know, where enslaved people were used as subjects. But more importantly, she said that the opinion research out there shows us pretty clearly that Tuskegee is not the driver. She pointed to one study that found
people who have never heard of Tuskegee are more likely than others to distrust medical research.
Which, you know, kind of makes sense when you think about it.
You know, people may not have known the encyclopedic history noted in my book, but they do know that their own families and the families of their friends and many people they know have over generations been abused in the medical research arena.
I mean, a year into this pandemic, we have been having this conversation so many times of just how many different ways there are inequalities in how Black people get treated for medical conditions in this country.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that Harriet Washington sort of underlined is like we need to look at these inequities and how they affect the way Black people feel about the medical establishment. You know, just as one example, our colleagues Renee Montaigne and the Science Desk, they looked into the ways that Black women, you know, up and down the income scale are much more likely to die during or after childbirth than our white women. You know, there are still all these huge differences in medical treatment that we get depending on our race. And, you know, when you zoom out, we have all these social realities that play a big role in the kind of medical treatment we get because of things like housing segregation and discrimination. Black people are more likely to live, you know, in old housing stock with lead paint, more likely to live near landfills or factories, you know, less likely to live in neighborhoods with trees and clean air. Here's Harriet Washington again.
Look at the data. They tell us that African-Americans who make $50,000 or $60,000 a year, who are, you know, solidly middle class by most standards, they are far more likely to be exposed than our whites who earn only $10,000 a year, which is profoundly poor. Profoundly poor whites are less likely to be exposed to environmental toxins than our African Americans who are middle class. So you can't rely on socioeconomic data to find disease risk.
I mean, as you tick through all of these damning stats, it's pretty clear there are a whole lot of reasons why a person of color might be hesitant to go to the doctor, to get engaged in the healthcare system, to go sign up for a vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on top of just having less access to healthcare to begin with, you know, Black people are showing up to the doctor sicker. And when they do show up to the doctor, they're getting worse treatment. Harriet Washington says, you know, we're talking about Black people's distrust as the problem, and not the lack of trustworthiness of the healthcare system.
It's not only lazier, but it's a lot easier to simply evoke Tuskegee. But it's simply not true. And it's not scientifically rigorous.
Harry says, frankly, we know better at this point, and we should do better.
That's NPR's Gene Demby on the long-lasting effects of the Tuskegee syphilis study and broader ongoing inequities in healthcare. Gene, thank you.
Thank you so much, Scott. I'm honest when I'm saying Denmark's the promised land. I'm moving down here just to chill and eat vegetables.
Now I gotta go back to the Roskilde Festival, Denmark style. Europe's tourist industry has taken a beating during this pandemic. And as one way to boost travel, Denmark is introducing vaccine passports. The digital documents provide proof of a traveler's COVID-related health, eliminating the need to quarantine upon arrival in a new country. Opponents fear that this could create billions of second-class citizens. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports.
London's Gatwick Airport has been little more than a giant jet parking lot since COVID struck. It symbolises how we've all been imprisoned by the coronavirus. Governments across the world hope vaccinations will liberate their citizens and economies. The British government is backing research by a company led by Andrew Budd. It specialises in facial recognition technology.
The World Health Organization is currently working on international standards for digital vaccine certificates, which will make this much more feasible.
Budd says his system is ready to roll.
The technology of this is the easy bit of it. We've built this technology so that it can be trialled, so that it can be put into different use cases, and the political and social and ethical aspects of this can be explored. Those are the real challenges of vaccine certificates.
Vaccination passports give rise to some really significant human rights and civil liberties concerns.
Rosalind Comin is the policy and campaigns manager of Liberty, a non-profit that challenges injustice and inequality in Britain.
In essence, what vaccine passports are trying to do is create a system whereby some people can access freedoms, services, or other kind of spaces and places, and other people are excluded from them.
Demonstrations have already taken place in Copenhagen. Chanting Freedom for Denmark, protesters marched against government plans to introduce a vaccine certificate. Lars Sandahl Sørensen is a leading advocate for the project.
We think that it's going to open up society substantially. It has the potential to do that.
Why is that?
Well, simply that you can then start accessing restaurants, venues, sports venues, but certainly also give you the opportunity to travel and to document to authorities that you actually have a vaccine, you actually have been tested, etc.
But isn't there a danger of vaccine apartheid?
In our opinion, absolutely not. It is going to help to open society, to create more mobility for all of us who need to go out and interact with other people.
Restoring tourism to Copenhagen is just one objective of Danish business, and of Jens Zimmer Christensen, who heads Danish and pan-European restaurant lobbying groups. He owns a restaurant not far from this harbour, but he has reservations.
There are also a number of people we should not forget. There are people with allergies, there are pregnancies, and then there are some which do not believe in vaccination at all. One way or the other, they have to be included in society also in the future.
Tourism generates $200 billion a year for Spain. The European Union's decision to back vaccine certification is good news for Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez.
The objective, in the view of the Spanish government, is to resume normality in the tourism industry as soon as possible, without increasing a sanitary risk.
The rich people can get the vaccination, or the rich country can get the vaccination, and they're going to be the only ones able to travel.
Gloria Guevara from Mexico is CEO of the World Travel and Tourism Council. Globally, the industry has lost $100 billion during the pandemic. Empty cruise ships represent a small fraction of that figure. With poorer countries struggling to vaccinate their citizens, Guevara opposes vaccine passports.
You might have two people, for instance, competing exactly for the same job with exactly the same skills, and just one having the vaccination and the other one no. And the question is that going to be the driver to decide who do you hire? I don't think so.
Assalamu alaikum, Khawateen Hazrat.
Vaccination passports are some way off for community leader Sabia Akram. Her priority is combating resistance to the vaccine amongst ethnic minorities. She's in the Muslim cemetery in Slough, west of London, urging British Pakistanis to get inoculated. Slough is one of Britain's most ethnically diverse towns. There's concern that anti-vax conspiracy theorists have swayed young Asians and those with Afro-Caribbean heritage.
I'm not really that bothered by the vaccine. I kind of don't trust it, so yeah, that's why I'm not going to get it.
Sabia Akram is worried that vaccine scepticism will exacerbate racial differences in Britain.
I think that divide that already exists will just become greater. I think it's more important than ever for ethnic minorities to understand their vulnerabilities, some of the inherent genetic disorders and diseases that they are vulnerable to. That message hasn't been loud and clear enough from public health. And COVID is just another virus that will seek out their vulnerabilities and unfortunately cause death.
Those who don't get inoculated face exclusion from sections of the job market, as more organisations, such as Britain's Health Service, contemplate making vaccination a condition of employment.
Well, very clear, no jab, no job.
Charlie Mullins owns a high-profile repair and service company and is among Britain's most vocal advocates of the vaccine.
As an employer, we have an obligation and a duty to make sure that our staff are safe and to our customers that are safe. And there's many, many people in the UK that will crawl across the snow half naked to get this vaccine done at the moment.
Those views resonated on Slough's main street.
You need to take the vaccine to save others. So I think it's quite important that people can see that you took the vaccine, that they can differentiate between the person who took the vaccine and the one who didn't take the vaccine.
I'm on my way to have the COVID vaccination. This is the first inoculation that I've had since 2011.
The last time was a real disaster. I had the yellow fever vaccine that fried my brain and sent me crazy, and we lost absolutely everything. And I have to say that my wife and my son are full of trepidation today as I go to have this vaccine, but I want to have it because I want my freedom back.
Ready?
Sure.
Ready?
Yep.
If everything runs on schedule, I should get my second shot in about 3 months' time, and then my interim vaccine certificate will be fully loaded. The documentation envisaged by the European Union will be digital. For millions of Britons, local attractions are losing their allure after a year of lockdown. And as winter fades, more exotic pastures beckon. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in Brighton.
Disturbing video of an arrest near Lansing that's now led to criminal charges against a state trooper over how he handled his police dog. Trooper Parker Serbrook joined MSP in 2012, working his way up to becoming canine handler.
Now prosecutors determined Serbrook crossed a line during an arrest back in November. An internal investigation was launched after Serbrook's supervisor saw this dash cam video. As Priya Mann reports, state police released the dash cam video on the same day the trooper appeared before a Lansing judge.
Dash cam video shows Trooper Parker Serbrook's canine was on that suspect for more than 3.5 minutes while that man pleaded with the trooper to pull his dog off of him.
Please, I'm begging you, sir. Please, sir. Please. Please, sir.
A Michigan State Police supervisor filed a complaint against canine handler Trooper Parker Serbrook after reviewing this dash cam video.
Please, sir, he's on my face. I don't care. I'm not moving.
Last November, Trooper Serbrook was part of a multi-jurisdictional task force. He was following a vehicle in Lansing where police believed a passenger was armed. When the driver crashed his car into a tree, Trooper Serbrook deployed his canine.
Stop him! Stop him! Stop him! Stop him!
With the canine on the driver, both troopers rushed toward the passenger.
I'm trying to get the gun.
With neither suspect cuffed, Trooper Serbrook repeatedly asks whether other officers are close.
Can we get some backup down here, you guys?
The driver begins to plead for Trooper Serbrook to remove the canine, saying his leg is broken.
Got him!
I've got security over here.
Sir, please, sir, my leg is broken.
Minutes later, backup arrives.
Don't move! Put your other hand behind your back!
Yes, sir. I can't move my leg, sir.
After reviewing the video, Trooper Serbrook was charged with one count of felonious assault.
Good boy. Good boy. All right.
And the director of MSP released a statement saying, while the unfortunate reality for police officers is that use of force is sometimes a necessary action to ensure the protection of themselves or others, care and concern for human life should always be at the forefront of any police officer's actions. This makes Trooper Serbrook's disregard of the driver's pleas for help totally unacceptable. And that trooper will be back in court on the 18th. I'm Priya Mann, Local 4.
All right, Priya, Serbrook is on an unpaid suspension and was removed from the canine unit. His canine was reassigned to another handler.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the white collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
We've learned an 18-year-old accused of killing two people and hurting a third in Kenosha will not go to trial for at least 7 months. Kyle Rittenhouse's trial was pushed back this morning during a court appearance. 27 Sarah Masler-Donar joins us with the earliest he could face a jury. Sarah.
Good morning, Caroline. Yeah, this happened just a few short hours ago. Rittenhouse's trial was originally expected to start on March 29th, but both sides told the judge this morning that they needed more time to prepare. Not uncommon in big cases like this. A lot of times, both sides want to get all their ducks in a row. So with that news in mind, the circuit court judge in Kenosha County pushed the trial back 7 months for a start date of November 1st. Now, as we've reported, Rittenhouse is charged with multiple felonies, including reckless homicide and reckless endangerment. The shootings he's accused of happened during one of the nights of protests in Kenosha that followed the shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, at the hands of a white officer during a domestic disturbance call. Now, it is important to note that the judge in this case this morning did caution that the trial could be pushed back even further. So it's safe to say, Caroline, that even with this November 1st trial date set now, that's not even something that we could say is set in stone. So we will be following development out of this very closely.
Listen, just touching on some real issues right here tonight. That's all.
That's all.
I want y'all to observe the excellence here. BX providing the Sonics, my man, Minnesota. I'm letting the beat ride out because it's a part that I like when it come up, you know what I'm saying? I take this time to say what's up to my family. You hear that? You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Just observe the excellence of that. That's many.
Hey, back. Fall back.
With the guitars. It's hip-hop music. It's good enough to speak for itself. And you gotta do right by it. Minnesota.
Black people in Minnesota? It's the first criminal trial in Minnesota to be broadcast live in its entirety. That is just one indication of the public interest in the murder case against Derek Chauvin. He's the former police officer filmed with his knee on George Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes. That video spread around the world and sparked global protests. So, being a juror on such a high-profile case could feel overwhelming, maybe even a little scary. So far, 6 jurors have been chosen, and NPR's Layla Fadel is here to talk about this. Hey, Layla.
Hi.
So I'm thinking, yeah, if you're being interviewed to serve on potentially the most historic trial of our time involving race and policing, that would feel like a privilege, but might also well feel a little overwhelming.
Right. I mean, I'll just start with what a prospective juror sees walking into the county government center. And that's the building where the courtroom is. It's been outfitted specifically for this case being tried in the midst of a pandemic. The building is encased by fencing, razor wire at the top, National Guardsmen outside, military style vehicles. And then when you get into that courtroom, it's being broadcast live. Prospective jurors' names are withheld. Their faces don't appear on camera, but we can hear their voices. And there was one young man on the first day of jury selection who was clearly nervous. He told the judge he was uncomfortable. Here he is responding to one of the lawyers asking him questions.
The case itself is just very, this whole thing is very divisive, and I'm not a divisive person. I just rather not be part of something that's so two-sided.
Hmm. Oh, you can hear he sounds nervous. Was that something you heard from other prospective jurors?
Yeah, I mean, some jurors were actually really excited at the prospect of serving on a historic jury, and then others were nervous, like this young man. This case has sparked a national conversation on systemic racism, on who gets to protest, who gets to feel safe with law enforcement, and who doesn't. Over the past year, we saw Black Lives Matter protesters demonized, largely by the right, as violent rioters, despite the fact that the vast majority of protests have been peaceful. In Minneapolis, buildings did burn, law enforcement used rubber bullets and tear gas, and so all of this really polarizing stuff that's dividing the country is what is also at the center of this case. And we're hearing that in the questions being asked of potential jurors as attorneys on both sides try to figure out the politics of prospective jurors, their feelings on law enforcement, on race. Here's another prospective juror from this morning.
With a high-profile case, I know everything becomes public. So depending on what's ruled, that could be a problem later on down the line or even in the process.
So she was concerned about safety, but also said it would be traumatizing to rewatch that video. She was excused. Another spoke about the scrutiny.
The decision the jury makes has maybe broader implications, reactions from the general public, and just so it's more that knowing that the people, general public, is paying attention to the decision and more pressure, I guess, to get it right.
So some of the voices there of potential jurors. One other development just to ask you about while we've got you, Layla. The judge today reinstated the third-degree murder charge against Chauvin. What is the significance of that?
Well, typically this is a charge that's brought in cases of recklessness that endanger more than one person. So cases like drug dealers charged after overdoses. But in a decision just days before jury selection from the appellate court, that decision decided it could be used in cases that aim at one person. And so today, Peter Cahill reinstated that charge bound by a higher court.
NPR's Layla Fadel reporting. Thank you, Layla.
Thank you.
You can't lay down with white supremacy at night and get up in the morning and fight it. It's just not going to happen.
A contradiction. Can you unpack that for us a little bit? A contradiction. Can you unpack that?
Sure. I'll just give you an example. If we were discussing just a few minutes ago about how black people will appease white people, how their behavior will change with white people, how we will say things, even agree with racist attitudes and things to appease them. We don't want them to think that we dislike them. We don't want them to think this or that. We put on these false faces, and we talk about that a lot in the book, the white identified black person, for example. And so now you've got this false face, and we can see it play out every day in our interactions. White people also wear a false face around us. So you've got these two people who traditionally and historically and routinely wear false faces with each other. Now they're coming together in a relationship. What is going to happen in that relationship, I believe, and in all of this is just my opinion, is you're going to have a falseness in that relationship. The black person is going to be trying to appease the white person by denying their reality. In order for them to get along with that white person, they have to deny their reality. Otherwise, there's going to be a conflict. Because even white people who get involved sexually or romantically with black people, they really don't want to know what you're going through. They really don't want to talk or hear about racism or white supremacy. They want you to pretend that you're not going through anything that puts their group, their race, in a bad light. So that means to get along with them, you have to deny who you are, what you are, your history, and everything else. Now imagine these people coming together in a relationship with these false faces. The black person, to me, is at great psychological risk when they have sex with or marry and date white people. Not because white people are bad people, but because racism, white supremacy, creates a falseness in that relationship automatically.
We begin with Harry and Meghan. The main opposition party in Britain has called for the royal family to investigate an allegation of racism made in a US television interview with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. In a two-hour programme, they made a series of dramatic revelations about their life inside the British royal family. In their first interview since moving to the US, Meghan and Harry told Oprah Winfrey about their fears for their mental health while remaining in the UK. The couple gave details of their rift, including a claim that someone within Buckingham Palace voiced concerns about how dark their son Archie's skin would be. At the same time, Prince Harry spoke about his disappointment about how his father, Prince Charles, behaved. They also revealed they exchanged vows in a secret ceremony 3 days before the wedding we all saw in 2018, and they're expecting a daughter in the summer. Our correspondent in Los Angeles, David Willis, watched the interview go out on primetime TV.
Well, we learnt a variety of things, Alex. Prince Harry saying that his family has cut him off financially and he's living off the money he inherited from his mother, Diana. Remarking, of course, as we heard, about his relationship with his father having been damaged and Prince Charles refusing to answer his calls at one point. Those suicidal thoughts on the part of Meghan Markle, which you mentioned. Conversations within the royal household about how dark her unborn son's skin might be. And she also said that the royal family had taken her passport, keys and driving license when she married Harry and tried to limit her movements. So above all else, I think, it revealed how lonely, how isolating life can be within the royal family and how the people running it, known as the firm, exert such tight control. I might add it's also been revealed that we got a little insight into the somewhat cozy behind-the-scenes relationship between the royal family and the tabloid press in the UK, including holiday parties at the palace. Meghan Markle making the point that the press always wanted a narrative, as she put it, of hero and villain, a reference to her sister-in-law, Kate.
Just how big a story is this in the United States?
Well, America has no royal family of its own, of course, and there's an old saying that British appreciation of American celebrities is rivaled only by American appreciation of British royals. They loved the diversity that Meghan brought to the royal family, and they've also seen it down the years, Americans, as a real-life soap opera, if you like. We haven't got the viewing figures for this interview yet, but it will almost certainly be one of, if not the most watched events of the year here, such as the level of interest.
David Willis. There's been a lot of reaction to the interview already in the UK, where people won't be able to watch it in full until this evening. These early morning commuters in London had this to say.
I think they've done the wrong thing, and I'm sorry, really, because I don't think they've done themselves any good at all.
I just think it's really sad that family matters can't be played out within their family, and at a time when so many people are suffering due to losing people due to the coronavirus, losing their jobs.
I think it's a good thing that people can hear about the experience in the royal family. It's not such a blocked-off experience anymore, so I think that's good.
There's been no response from Buckingham Palace so far. Our royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph, is following developments.
A lot of the senior members of the royal family won't have watched this live overnight, so you can expect some of them to be given a briefing this morning. There will then have to be discussions within the royal household about whether this warrants some kind of response. There is so much to unpick inside this interview. A lot of it is also very personal. There are some things that they just won't address in any detail, but perhaps some of the more wider institutional problems that Meghan in particular talked about, not being supported when she went to seek help, wanting that level of support to help her out of her isolation and help her mental health, that was not forthcoming, she said. Could they perhaps address some of those more institutional issues around those areas rather than the more personal stuff? I think that's possible, but I think this morning they will be looking at what's been said and trying to make a judgment call on whether it's worth responding or referring to the position that they often take, which is to say nothing at all.
Our royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
According to early data, 17 million people in America watched Oprah Winfrey's interview with Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. During their two-hour conversation, the couple made a series of allegations about life inside the royal family. Meghan said that she had had suicidal thoughts but had been refused help. Harry claimed his father, Prince Charles, had at one point refused to take his calls. But potentially the most damaging comment came when Meghan spoke about their son, Archie.
In those months when I was pregnant, all around this same time, so we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title, and also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
What? And you're not going to tell me who had the conversation?
I think that would be very damaging to them.
That clip, courtesy of Harpo Productions and CBS. The royal family hasn't commented, but Oprah Winfrey later confirmed it was neither Queen Elizabeth nor Prince Philip who had made the alleged comment about skin colour. Our correspondent, Adina Campbell, takes a look at some of the reaction to the programme.
Prince Harry and Meghan's allegations that there were concerns within the royal family about how dark their son's skin would be have caused some shock, making headlines and prompting discussion on social media around the world. Commentator Dr. Shola Mosh Shagamimbu was one of the many people outraged by what she heard.
Who does that? And people would say, well, families talk about who's going to look like who. No, families don't discuss, well, let's have a conversation about how dark his skin might be and what that might mean. What does that mean? Is Archie going to be loved less? Is he not going to be given the same rights, birthright, as his cousins?
The tennis star Serena Williams, one of Meghan's closest friends, is one of a number of famous names who've shown their support for the Duchess on Twitter. She wrote, "I know firsthand the sexism and racism institutions and the media use to vilify women of colour, to minimise us, to break us down and demonise us." But Prince Charles's biographer, Jonathan Dimbleby, said people should not leap to conclusions. He said Harry's comments about his relationship with his father might lead some to wonder whether Charles was behind the alleged remarks.
I would find it quite astonishing. I know him. I've known him for a long time. I've seen him with all kinds of different people of all religions, all faiths, all ethnic groups in this country and elsewhere in the world. I have never seen a hint of that. On the contrary.
There's no doubt that this interview has divided opinion about the couple. One thing is clear, though. The conversation about race in the UK has yet again raised uncomfortable and tough questions.
Adina Campbell.
Queen Elizabeth's grandson, Prince William, has spoken for the first time since his brother and sister-in-law's TV interview to insist that the British royal family isn't racist. It follows the assertion by Prince Harry and his wife Meghan that an unnamed member of the family had expressed concern about the skin tone their then unborn baby would have. Following the broadcast, Buckingham Palace produced a 61-word statement which affirmed the family's love and concern for Prince Harry and his family, but said little else. I asked our royal correspondent Sarah Campbell why she thought William had spoken out now.
Well, apart from the statement, of course, which was released on Tuesday on behalf of Her Majesty the Queen, but this is the first time we've heard a member of the royal family actually speak about it. Prince Charles was at an engagement a couple of days ago. He chose to not answer a question which was put to him. But this morning, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, that's Prince William and Catherine, were visiting a school in East London to talk about sort of the reopening of schools here. And he was asked a couple of questions and he did answer, as we can hear.
Sir, have you spoken to your brother since the interview?
No, I haven't spoken to him yet, but I will do.
And can you just let me know, is the royal family a racist family, sir?
No, we're very much not a racist family.
And Sarah, why do you think he spoke out? You mentioned the Queen's statement. She said this was all going to be dealt with privately.
Yes, she did. The line from that, the issues raised, particularly that of race, are concerning. While some recollections may vary, they are taken very seriously and will be addressed by the family privately. Prince William there obviously hasn't spoken to his brother. He explained that he hadn't spoken to his brother, but he intended to do so, and clearly felt strongly enough about the accusation that there's racism within the family. And don't forget, this is an accusation that has been on headlines, newspapers, televisions around the world. Felt strongly enough about it that he felt he had to say something in response. We're very much not a racist family.
Because a lot of things were said in the interview, there was criticism of members of the royal family. But do you think this was absolutely the most damaging allegation?
It was certainly one of the most incendiary. And this was the conversation where she relayed a conversation that Harry had had, whereby in conversation with a member of the royal family who remained unnamed, that member of the family had questioned with concern how dark their baby's skin would be. It was a very, very difficult issue for the family, who they would argue have spent many years promoting diversity, promoting inclusion around the world. I think Prince William clearly felt that the allegation was so strong that he could not say anything about it.
Sarah Campbell.
And I understand that you don't like Meghan Markle. You've made it so clear a number of times on this programme.
Even by the standards of a show in which confrontation is nothing new, this between two of its presenters this morning was extraordinary.
But yet you continue to trash her.
OK, I'm done with this.
No, no, no.
Sorry, no. Sorry.
Do you know what? That's pathetic.
You can trash me, maybe not my
no,
own
No, no, no.
See you later.
I'm being...
Sorry, can't
this
do this.
This is absolutely diabolical behaviour.
The clash followed Piers Morgan's angry on-air reaction yesterday to the interview the Duchess of Sussex had given to Oprah Winfrey, Morgan saying he didn't believe her.
This is a two-hour trash-a-thon of our royal family, of the monarchy, of everything the Queen has worked so hard for.
So were you thinking of harming yourself? Were you having suicidal thoughts?
Yes, this was very, very clear.
The fact that she'd spoken about her mental health resulted in a huge backlash against the GMB presenter. The mental health charity Mind saying it was disappointed and concerned, and the watchdog Ofcom receiving 41,000 complaints. This evening, ITV issued a statement saying, following discussions with ITV, Piers Morgan has decided now is the time to leave Good Morning Britain. ITV has accepted this decision and has nothing further to add.
Right now, it's never been more important that as a nation we keep talking.
The incident will have been of particular concern to the network after its high-profile launch in 2019 of Britain Get Talking, a mental wellness campaign encouraging people to talk openly about their issues.
I can't comment on what he should or shouldn't do. I think it's just a shame that he didn't think quickly enough to realise just how important it is for the thousands of people out there who are struggling with their mental health.
Piers Morgan was hired to co-host Good Morning Britain 6 years ago.
Piers Morgan is here for a few days? Or
no, no, I'm here permanently. It's your ultimate nightmare, I'm afraid.
His outspoken and often controversial views dividing opinion on screen and online. In the past week, the show has reported its highest ratings ever. But one former guest says now the presenter has overstepped the mark.
If you hire a Rottweiler for its ability to bite, you can't then be shocked when it actually bites.
When Morgan returned to the set this morning, shortly after he'd walked off, he attempted to explain his views on mental health.
Mental illness and suicide, these are clearly extremely serious things that should be taken extremely seriously. And if somebody is feeling that way, they should get the treatment and the help that they need.
But the damage had clearly been done. This would be his last appearance on The Breakfast Show. Nina Nanarm, News at 10.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 13, 2021, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Before we get started, there were so many things that happened this week. Marvelous Marvin Hagler passed away today. Boxing legend reminded me of the sweetest, it's the Bitter Sweet Science. That's it, the Bitter Sweet Science, Dr. Gerald Horn. His book that should be coming out sometime this year. Last time I checked, it was, I think the pre-release was there, but it wasn't officially released. But I suspect Marvin Hagler may be mentioned in that book, but he just passed away a few hours ago. I just saw right when we were getting ready to go live. Lots of tragedies, losses over the past 13 months or so. And I think we had a guest who talked about one of the forms of black male privilege being that professional sports is generally biased or more welcoming to black male athletes, Floyd Mayweather and the like, where they can go out and make a lot of money, LeBron James, that type of thing. I said, really? That's what you're talking about? Marvin Hagler, deceased at the age of 66. And he's in the Hall of Fame, right? This wasn't somebody who had like some modest, mediocre career, like one of the best of all time, big pay-per-view events and what have you, and deceased at the age of 66. Black male privilege. Compensatory call in. The number to dial is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Speaking of passings, lengthy list. I will get to the callers when I get to the callers this week. There's so many things that happen. I'm generally surprised because sometimes there'll be so many things that happened and people won't really have very many comments on the news clips. Like, we could leave all of the callers on mute today and I could just talk for the rest of the program until, you know, I run out of things that happened this week and things to say. I could probably do that and not even have very much to say about Meghan Markle. So I will start something that was not even included in the clips. So way back, this is 2014, Lawrence Otis Graham. He has written many books. Some might call him a sellout or some other names for black. He doesn't speak very honestly about racism, white supremacy, victim of racism. Nonetheless, victim of racism. So Lawrence Otis Graham, this black male, and he had written books for like 20 years or so. At the end of 2014, his son was terrorized. His son was about 14, 15 years old, and his son was terrorized. And I think he was walking outside the campus, and some racist drove by and called him a nigger and, you know, all the rest, standard operating procedure. And so his son at this elite, their term, white school, he is trying to talk about this. He's traumatized. And they're like, hey, we don't want to, you know, talk about all that nonsense. You know, hush up. Should be happy we allowed you to hang out here. Leave our white women alone, too. And so he wrote this report, Mr. Lawrence Otis Graham, after, as I said, he's like known as someone who doesn't speak particularly honestly about racism, white supremacy. I don't think he's called a militant. I don't think they call his hair militaristic, at least not to his face anyway. But so he might even be called with a conservative, right? That term that they use, whatever that means. So after this incident happens with his offspring, he comes out and writes this report for the Washington Post. I want to make sure I can read the exact title because this is the first thing I thought of. Lawrence Otis Graham died just a few days back at the age of 59. Black male privilege. But the first thing I thought of is this report that Mr. Graham wrote in 2014. Let me give you the full title of the article. It is, I Taught My Black Kids That Their Elite Upbringing Would Protect Them From Discrimination. I Was Wrong. That's the first thing that I thought of when I read, wow, Mr. Graham deceased at the age of 59. And he wrote one of his books. I have to get the title of it. I've not read it, but I said, oh, we should read this now for the book club. Even though I said, oh, we can't read it immediately. I have a rule about reading books when a black person has died because they end up being very bad. So I end up complaining about a book where a black person has just died. That's happened too many times. So we'll have to read it like later. But he wrote this book talking about how he is like one of the few black people that's allowed, I think it's like one of the few members of the club or something like that, where he's allowed to be with white people and work with white people and that sort of thing in the elite circles. Whew, to contrast that with this report, like, wow, I have not given accurate information to my offspring. We talked about that last week, probably talk about that again this week. Very important to speak honestly to your offspring about racism, white supremacy. We don't lie to our children about fire. Well, you shouldn't. We don't lie to our children about water. Well, you shouldn't. These are things that can kill you. They also can be used safely, but they can kill you. Racism can't even be used safely, and it can kill you or have you with a much shorter life and reduced quality of life than you should have. Mr. Graham, deceased at 59. Marvin Hagler, 66. Black male privilege. Let's see. Lengthy list. Wow, the list is lengthy. I can't even figure out where to begin. My goodness. Wednesday. My head hurts even trying to think of where to get to on the list. We should be here Wednesday. There's so many crazy things happening. If racism, white supremacy does not kill me between now and Wednesday, if I'm allowed to be here Wednesday, Renethia Tate should be back on the program. I've been thinking of Pam, Pamela Evans Harris, the late. I've been thinking of Pam. You heard her audio segment there. I'm sure she would have had a lot to say this here week. Thought it was appropriate to have her voice in the audio segment. But Pam is the reason that we know about Renethia Tate in terms of knowing about her book, Pieces of a Puzzle, which I suspect Meghan Markle has not read. And the reason that we got her on the program, Pam was relentless. And that is correct use of the term. Like, it was months, maybe even a year of dedication to track down Ms. Tate's contact info because it wasn't like easily available. At least I was not intelligent enough to locate it. And it took her like a long period of time. It was like we would have conversations. Like, I'm going to find it. I'm going to look. I'm going to look. And she did. She tracked down her information and she's been a guest on the program many times. And I was not. I'm not someone who's really into the royal family and, you know, what's Queen Elizabeth up to? And oh my, that is not Gus T. That has never been Gus T. So I was not all, ooh, we got to look at the wedding. And I didn't know who Meghan Markle was before all that. So, you know, I was not interested. But tragic arrangement. Okay, we'll, you know, do our diligence. I was thinking this week, like, oh, we should get Renethia Tate on to talk about this Meghan Markle thing. It's like, oh, wait, we did that. Royal tragedy. I had the hashtag and everything. 2018. We talked about that. We even put that in context. I think that was right when Serena Williams, who was mentioned, when she got married to a white man as well. But we talked about all of this. And that word fantasy, Renethia Tate said that so many times, and that word was invoked in the Oprah Winfrey special. But we will go into lots more detail about all that Wednesday, white supremacy, racism permitting, with Renethia Tate, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be sure to get a little acknowledgement to Pam in there as well, because that's the only reason that I have her contact information. Next, wow, what a week. So much to share. Let's see. The Wednesday, Renethia Tate will be here. Pam, I've been thinking about a lot. Muhammad Ali, for some reason, I've been thinking about a lot. And then he keeps resurfacing in the most peculiar ways. So I was thinking we should maybe, white people permitting, do Muhammad Ali in the book study, even though we have already read one of his books, Blood Brothers, or not one of his books, but a book on Muhammad Ali, Blood Brothers, about the friendship between Ali and Minister Malcolm X, written by suspected racists, had some info, some not, but that was one reason. I think the film Four Nights in Miami just released, which, you know, features Mr. Ali about the night he and Minister Malcolm, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke are hanging out. One of the few films I can actually say that I've seen, and I mean, it is a super short list. Black Panther isn't even on the list, that has a predominantly black cast where I didn't want to vomit. Where I actually thought, wow, I could actually watch this again and not want to retch. And I'd say I could even give a counter racist review. What's this film about? What is your life going to be about? That is the review. That's my assessment. I could be wrong, but why would I not enjoy a film where I think that is the thing? Muhammad Ali wins this championship. Jim Brown at the peak of his football career and acting. Sam Cooke and all of that. And then have this militant Negro. What is your life supposed to be about? Is this it? Go and beating up black people to entertain white people? Go and sing songs to entertain white people? Go and tote a ball to entertain white people? In a system of racism, white supremacy, where no one is guaranteed tomorrow, what is your life supposed to be about? That would be the film review. Wouldn't need to add anything else. Is that what the film is about? I think that's what the film is about. I could be wrong. Anyway, but Muhammad Ali is in that film, but then he kept coming up repeatedly where I was thinking, like, wow, what in the world is going on? So we're reading in the book club, Geronimo Pratt, Tragedy and Last Man Standing, Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. Vietnam veteran, COINTELPRO victim, as was everyone I just mentioned, Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, Minister Malcolm X, Sam Cooke. So in that book, he talks about his Vietnam experience, talk about anti-Asian violence. He talks about his Vietnam experience, Mr. Pratt. I said, oh, yeah, you get all of this detail. And he talks about people being blown up and having shrapnel stuck in his body and having to go here and kill these non-white people and then seeing his white counterparts raping non-white people and brutalizing children and elderly people. Oh, that Muhammad Ali fella might have had some good reasons for saying, nah, I don't think I want to be a part of any of that. No, thank you. Then, just today, matter of fact, it happened twice this week. So the white fella, one of them, they did the break-in, right, for the COINTELPRO papers. How do we even get some of this information about what happened to Geronimo Pratt, Muhammad Ali, all the rest of these folks? These white people break into the office in Media, Pennsylvania, the FBI office, that's what's reported, to get these documents, come back and say, oh, wow, look what they're doing to the Negroes, black bookstore owners and all that. The day that they do the break-in is the fight between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. They say we planned it that way because we knew everyone would be watching the fight. No one would be paying attention. And they mentioned it twice. He was on NPR today. Under any other circumstances, we would have heard that clip. It was on NPR today. He was talking and giving an interview. Democracy Now!, my BFF, Amy Goodman, also was talking about that just 2 days ago, where they both mentioned Muhammad Ali is doing this fight. And remember, it's like, oh, wow, there he is again. I'd even have to give you some other ones where he popped up again over the past week in just the most strange ways. I'll have to note them as we go. But Muhammad Ali, for some reason, has been at the forefront of my mind as well. Let's see. Oh, the list is so. So this is one of the first times that we had an actual documentary within the news clips. I do not ever recall us doing a compensatory call in where there was a report that was not a segment from a news journalism site, right? There was a segment that's from the documentary film, Allen vs. Pharaoh. That is a, I think, four-part series. The last part of the series, I think, will be sometime tomorrow, maybe. Tomorrow, Monday, somewhere in there. That segment that we heard, segment three, where you heard they were talking about Paul Williams, black male. He did the investigation in Connecticut, thought it was founded. Then he gets fired. He said he believed the child. They fire him. Nah, get out of here. You're talking crazy. Woody Allen didn't molest any children. And then he ends up getting his job back and gets repay and everything. And his black female supervisor says, man, I watched all of this happen. She says, man, I couldn't continue to do this. Like, if Woody Allen had been one of these black families where we just go out and snatch children and you're an abuser and whatever you did, we're taking your child and whatever, like, man, his child would have been gone. This is what we do all day, every day. And this is a black female saying that. Again, the investigator, Paul Williams, that's a black male, black people saying, man, this Woody Allen fella, I think he did this. It looks like there's evidence that he molested, was raping these children, and we're just letting that roll. That's not what we do when it's black families. That's not what we do when it's poor families. Might be questionable evidence, and we still, very easy, take black, attempted father, attempted mother. You do not qualify. That series is amazing. What is it that idiot says all the time? What do he say? He says, white people do not care about children. Now, they do talk about Woody Allen raping Soon Yi in that segment. And didn't seem like a whole lot of people had a problem with that when this all came out back in the 90s, right? They were mad at O.J. Simpson and things. But the segment we heard, that was the investigation of whether he was raping a white female child. And they still, nah, don't even worry about it. Woody didn't do that thing. Make another film, Woody. Woody Allen. That's the New York. Even have people in the film. It reminded me of Jerry Sandusky. Talk about language. Reminded me they had the segment. They talked about Jerry Sandusky, white rapist, child rapist. They said Jerry Sandusky walked on water. Metaphor. Talking about Woody Allen in that documentary, they said Woody Allen, I worshipped Woody Allen. Talking in biblical terms about child rapists. White people do not care about children. Matter of fact, put it in context for this week, I wasn't thinking about it as workplace racism. I do make errors sometimes. They will show Woody Allen hanging out, most definitely. They will show Woody Allen hanging out at Madison Square Garden, hugged up on Soon Yi, give her a smooch on the kiss and everything. Go Knickerbockers, do it. Woo, we're going to get it this year. Patrick Flippin Ewing has his jersey retired at Madison Square Garden in the rafters, took them as close as they are going to get to a championship in the last 30 years. He goes into the garden. Excuse me, 7 foot Negro. Do you have some identification? I don't know who you are. Don't point to the ceiling. I don't care about that. Who are you? Reach for your wallet slow. He has to go out and give a press conference and say, man, I thought this was my house. I'm Patrick Ewing. I dunked on Michael Jordan and all the rest. You're another Negro. We got 7 foot Negros. We got 5 foot Negros. Spike Lee, remember the same thing happened to him. Charles Oakley, they got all his teammates too. We got all of you Negros. We got filmmaking Negros. Negros is Negros. And then Woody Allen can come in. They got the special entrance for Woody Allen and Soon Yi to come sit courtside. One special time we would have a documentary included in the news segments. And put that in anti-Asian violence. I get my segue. That's the way I posted that. When they give context. Oh, you got to watch that documentary. It is fantastic. They give context for showing Mia Farrow where they go and adopt, so-called, get all these non-white children, and it's right after Muhammad Ali again, Vietnam, all these destabled non-white areas, and oh man, Soon Yi was running around in the streets of Korea, and Mr. Fuller was over there, Korean War, was running around, and they didn't have any food, and just eating out of the gutter, oh, we'll take them. They had a little black child, and I think they had like two non-white children, all of this nonsense, and then he's grooming. That was the verbiage that they used, grooming Soon Yi so that she can be his sex partner. That is your anti-Asian violence right there. DDT, Vietnam, Korea, you can just keep adding them up. Woody Allen, all of this abducting of non-white children. That is your anti-Asian violence right there. Make sure we put that in the proper context. In fact, they have another documentary that's coming out next week. We just did The People versus O.J. Simpson. This documentary is The People versus Agent Orange. That is your anti-Asian violence right there. Talking about, I think, what is it now, 50 years of chemical and biological warfare where they got all kinds of mutations and non-white people having all these problems and birth defects. They weren't even born. Their parents weren't even born when the Vietnam War was happening, but they are still suffering. That is anti-Asian violence, if you want to use that term. I think it would be more accurate to just label that white supremacy racism. That was one of the reports from this week. We've heard a lot of those over the past year, I would say. Over the past 2 to 3 months, I have read and heard, even within the Cows broadcast, I have heard people allege that they think the reports about anti-Asian violence are being used to promote some sort of anti-blackness. I've heard that and I said, wow, that's interesting. I'll have to pay attention. And some of these people, they have, I also have to point out, no one that I have heard or read has presented a report. Like, no one has said this incident happened and this black person was accused of some sort of anti-Asian violence. No one has said, well, this particular show, this person was saying black people are to blame or black people are responsible. Like, no one that I have heard or read has said that. It's just been a perception. Or, a matter of fact, I'll read exactly what some of the people have said. So one person, he said, it is a highly suspect move for people who maintain a higher social position over someone in white supremacy to get them fired or deprived of anything rather than engage her directly. So, and this is just to give context, they were talking about Alexi McMahon. I think that's how you say it. McCammon. That's it. Alexi McCammon. Now, I even had to pause here. To give background, Alexi McCammon is a non-white female, that much I am sure of. It seems like she has a parent who would be classified as black. It looks like she might have one parent who's classified as white. So, another cowbell maybe, I'm not sure. At any rate, a non-white person. So, she this week, apparently she made some tweets that were accused of being anti-Asian, and she just got a job with, I believe it was Vogue, one of these magazines. She was going to get some sort of job, and people were upset. And these were old tweets. These were like tweets from 2013, like more than 5 years ago. And incidentally, some of these tweets, she was saying nigger with the A on the end. I don't know if that's anti-Asian violence or, you know, blame Kanye West for that too. I don't know what that is, but at any rate, this was one, the report that he was responding to and saying that I think this is a part of it. So I said, okay. So I'll go back and give the statement again. It's highly suspect move for people who maintain a higher social position over someone in white supremacy to get them fired or deprived of anything. Rather than engage her directly, they spent more effort pointing her out to white people. Interesting case. The thing that connects them all is that despite the situation, whenever the anti-Asian claims were sounding off, the people getting stepped, punched down on, and hammered the most were people classified as black, and white people were standing back as if they were not the main drivers. Okay. Now, this was on Twitter. So I asked this person if they had any other evidence of cases where the people that are being focused on stepped down, punched on, were punched down, stepped on, targeted, identified in these reports about anti-Asian violence. Can you think of any more? Do you have any more where these people are black? And he said no. And he said the only other one he could think of was going back to Akai Gurley. Now that is like, ooh. That's 6 years ago, and I don't remember people talking about anti-Asian violence during the Akai Gurley killing, but be that as it may, that was one. Now, I had another example of this happened on my Facebook page. Same thing happened. And this, or it wasn't exactly the same. The person said that they feel like the reports of anti-Asian violence are being used to promote anti-blackness. The word feel. I have feelings. We all have feelings. If you're human, you can feel hungry. You can feel tired. You can feel sleepy. You can feel nauseous. Lots of ways. When it comes to these reports, it's generally not a feeling. It would be evidence that I would be looking for. Evidence that there is some sort of anti-blackness about these reports when they talk about anti-Asian violence. That's what I would be looking for, and I didn't get that. Now, on Facebook, eventually, one person did find other incidents where there are reports, anti-Asian violence, and it is a black person who is accused of perpetrating these attacks. I got two. So if you're working along with me, I got two reports, a black person committing anti-Asian violence, so-called. We got Alexi McCammond, this non-white person who might have a white parent, and her tweets, right? So that's three. I had to do some digging. I think it was said last week, they're making it the headline, anti-Asian violence. Black people are somehow perpetrating or involved some sort of anti-blackness. I found a separate incident. So this is for Antoine Watson. Antoine Watson was not a headline by any stretch of the imagination. I'm going to tell you how I found Antoine Watson. There was a report that said an Asian man was pushed down. This happened in California. He was pushed down, and I thought it was a car incident because they used the word barreled. So I'm looking, and I'm thinking, is there a car? I don't see a car. And so I'm reading, I'm confused. I have to keep looking. I have to go to a number of reports and find out, oh, okay, there was no car. It was just a non-white person, so-called Asian male, and a black person runs across the street, apparently, and shoves this person. And he's talking to him like you can't hear anything, so you don't know what the context is. You just see him shove him, and it goes from there. But apparently, this is Antoine Watson. He's the one who's accused. They're saying that he's the one who did this, shoved him down. And they're looking to charge him. Now, you can't hear anything in the video. So, like I said, it's hard to get full context about what happened in this situation. But the first time I saw this incident reported, they didn't have his name included. They didn't have a picture. This wasn't like blown up with a big mugshot or anything like that. Nothing. You had to like dig, like you had to go and click extra links and put in his name and Antoine and all this. Like, it was not an easy locate at all. And this was after I had been looking. I'd been looking for this for a while because I'd been hearing people say this for a while, but I hadn't been seeing any reports. The name that I've been seeing most consistently when they talk about anti-Asian violence, our former president, Donald Trump. And beyond all of that, most of the time for these reports about anti-Asian violence, if you want to use that term, the people generally that I have been seeing accused look like they would be classified as white. I posted several of those on my social media sites. I would have included some of those if it had been a typical week on the plantation, but it has not been. I didn't even get to include those, but some of them were even white women who were going out and being engaged in some of these attacks. At any rate, I have not seen evidence that there is some sort of campaign, certainly not to make it a headline, that black people are responsible for spearheading anti-Asian violence. I have not heard any so-called Asian people. In fact, I haven't heard any white people or non-white people getting out on platforms, outlets saying that black people are to blame for anti-Asian violence. I have no idea where that talking point originated, but that's one. Show cause. And especially if you're going to say headline, oh yeah, show evidence. And that means I need to see where this was at the top of the news site. Like when you go to the New York Times, the very first article you would see, that's the headline. So show me where CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, The Young Turks, I don't know, Dallas Morning Star, Miami Herald, Chicago Tribune, LA Times, Seattle Times. Give me one where the headline has been Antoine Watson. Antoine Watson hasn't been the headlines of LA Times. I check LA Times every day. Give me one. I haven't seen that. I don't know where that talking point got started. If anything, I would say instead of anti-Asian violence, call it white supremacy. Definitely. You can specify that it's Asian people being attacked. And I have no problem because I agree. All that kung flu and the China virus and all that, it is racism, white supremacy. Just put that in context with DDT, Hiroshima, Woody Allen. Put that in context. We mistreat racist man, racist woman, racist child. We mistreat non-white people, period. Especially black people, but we mistreat non-white people, period. This is white supremacy racism. Other than that, show cause for the anti-blackness. Show cause. Let's see. The Megan Mark. I didn't even want to talk about that. I might not even talk about that. Oh, I have other. That's why I said I could have taken up the whole broadcast without any callers, and I probably would not even have to say anything about Meghan Markle. Man, what a crate. So the NPR report, they talked about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. Again, that's another one that I have talked about, things that have been agitating to just continue. And I'm so thankful they had Harriet Washington on that segment, Medical Apartheid, A Terrible Thing to Waste. Harriet A. Washington, brilliant. And she said in that segment, it's just lazy to just say, oh, yes, the Negros, they just are running around talking about Nurse Rivers and Tuskegee and, oh, they don't want to take the vaccine, as opposed to the lack of trustworthiness of white people, the coon man, and medical professionals in general. And again, I've not seen any other group with some sort of racial profile of their paranoia about the vaccine or anything. If they're not talking about black people and Tuskegee, when it just shifts to we're going to talk about non-black people and their thoughts or hesitancy about the virus, there's no racial mention at all. It's no, wow, why are all these white people out here burning masks? They were doing that in Colorado. Why are all these white people out here burning masks in dry ice? Why are all these white people saying that the vaccine is a hoax? What's up with it, man? They don't have none of those. They can do 50,000 reports all over the world about black people's hesitancy, but no other racial group, particularly white people, do not get a special focus as to why are they threatening to kidnap the governor over these virus restrictions? What is up with that? Anyway, the more interesting, well, I won't say more interesting, but an equally interesting component of that NPR piece, it originally aired on Thursday morning, I believe. In fact, I want to make sure I double check the segment that we heard. It originally aired on Thursday morning and was named Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment Casts a Pall Over COVID-19 Vaccinations. That was the original title of the report. And like I said, I believe that was on this past Thursday. Within like minutes, NPR's morning edition obviously airs in the morning. It comes on at like 5 a.m. Eastern time, somewhere around there. I'm on East Coast, so normally if I'm up at 2, it's on. I can catch it just before I go to bed type of a thing. But this aired, I believe, Thursday. Pulling it up now, they changed the title. So they had their original title up, as I just read, Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment Casts a Pall Over COVID-19 Vaccinations. They pretty quickly, within about an hour, changed that title to Racism in Medicine Casts a Pall Over COVID-19 Vaccinations. And in fact, if you look at the hyperlink, if you look at the URL, it still has the original title in the URL, the Tuskegee thing. And I looked at it and said, that's interesting. Like, I would agree. It's not Tuskegee. It's racism. That's another form of racial narrowing, in my opinion, because they're making it, isolating it to this one incident, as opposed to the coon man. All of the myriad of ways that white people practice racism, white supremacy within the medical establishment and beyond, not just this one small example that they try and pass off on Nurse Rivers. So I agree in that one scope, and I agree. I thought Harriet A. Washington was brilliant in that segment and just talking about the laziness. And in my view, it might even be another aspect of racism to just say that, oh, yeah, black people don't want to get the vaccine because of Tuskegee, and they're just bringing up this 70-year-old experiment and Nurse Rivers and all that, as opposed to the vast, the enormity with regards to the ways of white people practicing racism. Anywho, let's see. I could stop there. I guess I'll stop there, even though there are many other things that I could have said about the audio segments that were played. Obviously, the Meghan Markle situation, we'll have more to say about that as we move forward. I guess the only thing I'll say about the Meghan Markle, Gus T got an F. We have been on the air for 12 years. So in that time, the Cows has generated a lot of audio, 2,000 plus programs. And just accumulate, like you listen to lots of material and going back and trying to hear programs with Dr. Welsing or Mr. Fuller, or Pam, all the archives. So just trying to keep track of all that audio over 12 years is daunting. Dr. Welsing, her Welsing Institute went on for much longer than the Cows. During the 90s. Dr. Welsing did a Welsing Institute lecture where she talked about the death of Princess Diana, Dodie Fayed. I do not like speaking out of term. Strive for accuracy. I stress that all the time. Strive for accuracy. But I am very certain in that audio, because I heard it recently looking for something else, she talked about the death of Princess Diana, and she talked about the concern that sounded very similar to what was voiced in that interview about Dodie Fayed. Is he classified as white? How dark is he? If they are engaged, what color could the children be? Same type of reasoning and logic that we heard in the that was testified to in the Meghan Markle interview. I failed to locate the audio, although I'm very sure it's there. I have to just go back and wade through to just try to find exactly where it is. But I'm very, very certain that I have that audio somewhere in the archives. It was not on the Cows program. This is from a Welsing Institute from the 1990s. It was right. Princess Diana, I believe, passed in 1997. It was right in that time frame around 97, 98, where Dr. Welsing was talking about this. When I heard all of that, I just thought, wow, Welsing moment. I know she would have to be smiling in terms of confirmation for her theory. And why do white people do this? Practice racism, white supremacy. The Welsing theory of color confrontation. I know she would have to be smiling to have conversation. And matter of fact, if you watch the interview, when they brought Prince Harry out and Oprah, she did a brilliant job. She doubled back. She asked, like, what is this about this conversation about the child's skin complexion? And he said, oh, no, I don't want to talk about that. And Oprah didn't just let that one. She said, wait a minute. What do you mean? You can give us some information. Nope. Can't talk about it. I said, why? Because that was the only point that I heard in the interview where there was a complete stonewall, meaning, nope, nothing to say about that at all. I think Meghan Markle had said she wasn't going to divulge the details about what happened with a conflict that happened earlier. She just didn't want to go into all of that. But other than that, this was the only point where it was a total nothing, not going into details, not talking about that, not identifying who it was, not telling you what they said. Nope. Next question. Fifth Amendment. Next. Wow. Dr. Welsing, like, if it is that serious, like this has become like a matter of royal security and all the rest of it. Like, wow. Color confrontation. That's getting black. Get back. Yellow is mellow, white is right. And that would be, once again, white people are not confused about racism. If we're having these types of discussions, whoa, exactly how much pigment is this little fella going to have here? What they call a touch of the tar brush. You cannot be ignorant about racism if you're having that level of detailed conversation about, see, you are not colorblind, as they say, you are color obsessed. Dr. Welsing, the grandcestor. I'll stop there because we'll talk about that with Renevia Tate Wednesday. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see, if you could take about 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts, observations you have, that would be spectacular. If you know you're in an area with background noise, if you could kind of get to a quieter location, that would be awesome. Oh, I forgot. I knew they were more important than I had to pause right there. Got to pause right there. I knew I had more. The list was enormous. That's why I said I don't even know where to start at. Pause right there. With the whole Meghan Markle thing, there were many, many people, many, many. I talked to some of them verbally. I read some of the commentary online. Many individuals who I think are classified as non-white. I talked to some of these people. So some of these people are non-white. It's not like they're white people pretending. When they heard all of this about Meghan Markle, they said, hey, that's on her. You know, what's the metaphor? They say you make your bed, you got to lie in it, you know. You did this to yourself. You know, she know what it was. She chose. Nobody put a gun to her head, said you got to go and be a part of the royal family and marry this white man. She signed up for it. Hey, that's what you got to deal with. Tough cookies. I heard that from lots of folks that, you know, it's books out there. Pam tried to tell us. Dr. Welsing tried to tell us. Renevia Tate tried to tell us. You should have seen Monsters Ball. Get it together. I just thought, like, wow, that is callous. Like she was saying she felt suicidal. Like, I don't generally think that non-white people, my conclusion is that non-white people are confused. Myself, Cal's listeners, all of us, Neely Fuller Jr., all of us are confused about racism, white supremacy. I think the thing Mr. Fuller is most known for saying is still learning. Not, I figured it all out and the rest of you dumb coons don't know what you're talking about. That's not what he's known for saying. Still learning. I've concluded that non-white people are all still learning as it relates to racism, white supremacy. I won't say never. It's very rare for me to take the position that I think this non-white person is informed and they're just doing this for whatever reason, or it's very, very rare. This is not one of those rare exceptions. Why would I think she would be super informed about all this and knowledgeable about the dangers of tragic arrangements? The vast majority of non-white people that I talk to, even Cal's listeners, don't think there's anything dangerous about tragic arrangements. So why would I think she's an exception to the rule? Beyond that, it was the lack of empathy, because that's something that I see all the time. And in fact, I saw it this week, not just with Meghan Markle, although I saw a lot of it, right? It wasn't just Piers Morgan. I don't believe that heifer. Get out of here. She's lying. Get out. It wasn't just him. It was with the situation in Dallas. Mo told us about last week, or Plano, sorry, Plano, Texas, with the mom. I was so glad I played that segment. Like, man, the people who say listening to the news and all of that is rubbish, that it's a waste of time, I don't watch the news, I have no idea what you're talking about. That is like the most illogical, nonsensical thing in the world to just say, yeah, paying attention to the news and reading the news and what's being reported is a waste of time because it's all lies. Checking the news to get the report about what the details about what happened to this young black middle schooler in Plano, Texas, who was terrorized. I heard and saw people saying the same thing about this black or these black parents and saying, oh my God, what kind of idiots are these? Why would they let their son be at a white person's house anyway? What kind of lames are they? They should have known better. They're so stupid. And it was like, right on. That's right. I thought, wow, like, is there a book that has been published that has all of the information that you will need to be like a flawless black parent in a system of racism? If that book exists, Can we please have it, like, immediately? If there's any parent out there, I'm flawless. I don't make no mistakes. My child was calling Neely Fuller Jr. at 2. Got a patent for a spaceship at 5. Vegan garden at 6. Learned Spanish and Swahili at 7. I don't know what you're talking about, but being confused. Like, I got it. I don't know anything about all that. You know, I'm confused. I don't know how to talk to him about it. If that person exists, we can all hush and just have them talk to us until we feel satisfied that we got our act together. I don't think that person exists. But it was startling to see that consistent lack of empathy for non-white people, particularly with the black parent, to get additional information. Did you hear what she said? She said, my son approached me with this and we were skeptical. We didn't want to do it. It wasn't, oh yeah, I love white people. Let's do it. Let's go today. Matter of fact, stay over there a whole month. That's not what it was. It was, like, I don't know. Nah. In fact, she said it was no. And she said that her son, come on, mom, please. Come on, mom, please. Come on, mom. Wore her down over a week. Oh. That has been known to happen where children can wear you down about things. Ice cream, bad food, especially bad things that, you know, parents are trying to do the correct thing and they just nag and nag and nag. And like, you want your child to have those experiences, especially this year. I mean, man, getting a play date and being able to hang out with some friends and all the rest of it, being cooped up in the house. Like, man, it's Gus T says all the time, I am not going to be the person to sit out here and make a critique about somebody parenting or even act like I'm going to give some suggestions about this is the way to parent. I don't have child the first. And even if I did, I could not in any way imagine Gusty being a close to perfect parent. So, man, to sit out and be criticizing another victim of racism who's trying the best that they can to parent and do the correct thing and have this really traumatic situation happen. Like, man, just hearing her, she didn't sound like the most confused black person. She didn't sound like, you know, racism is what? What are you talking about? I love that. Did not sound like this young person's mother. It sounded like she was trying to do the right thing. And typical parents just being worn down, if anything, having us, I'm talking about us, non-white people, us trying to do the best that we can to study, learn about racism, white supremacy, so that we can have more info to share. That's why I talk about, hey, if we can study racism, white supremacy enough, what does it mean to be white? You can explain to your child, no, you can't go to that person's house because we have rules about going to white people's house. Do you see me going to any white people's house? Do I have any white friends? Why do you think that? See, you can have a long dialogue about why this is a no, not just even, well, I don't know, maybe she did tell him why she's skeptical, but it wouldn't just be I'm skeptical. It would be, oh, absolutely not. We do not go to white people's houses. That is so, so dangerous for so many reasons. Some of the exact things that we talk about, they have firearms and alcohol, all kinds of things. Like, no way. You could die. I could die. Like, all kinds of bad things could happen. Like, that would be the conversation. Like, same way that you explain fire, you know, you just give them all the details in terms of why this has got to be a no. Like, you can ask today, tomorrow, next week, next year. Matter of fact, you're not going to keep asking why, because this is dangerous. Like, this is the equivalent of you asking to drink poison. Like, you can't keep asking to drink poison every day. You'll kill yourself. What are you not understanding here? But all of that to say, man, the lack of empathy, that is a huge component of white supremacy, racism, finding a reason. I verbally said this to someone because I was experiencing this with the Meghan Markle situation. I said, she knows what she was doing. I don't feel sorry for her. And I said, man, it doesn't seem to matter. The situation, whether it's a black mom in Texas where her child is made to drink urine and they get a BB gun and shoot him in the groin. Meghan Markle says she's about to die. I'm about to kill myself. Should have did better. Tighten up. Get your act together. Like, wow. Like that callousness, in my opinion, is a major component of white supremacy racism. We are encouraged to justify racism being practiced. We are encouraged to minimize when white people practice racism, white supremacy against us. It's no big deal. The black person did something to deserve it. He probably had his pants hanging off of his behind or something of that nature. That is rampant within the system of white supremacy racism. You don't have to love the non-white person. It doesn't mean that you have to think that that person made the best decisions or anything of that nature. But I mean, wow, it should not be a situation where a black mom has her child tortured and the commentary is, what a lame she is, what a dumb parent. Like, nothing about that seems correct. Nothing about that seems moving in the direction of universal man, universal woman. And again, I would add, since this was coming from other victims of racism, when we get to all that brother and sister, this is the type of thing that I'm thinking about. If this was our sister, we certainly wouldn't be saying all that. It'd be, man, let's sympathize with a mom whose child was tortured, could have been killed. Anyway, brothers and sisters, the number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate for this broadcast. If you could not use metaphors, that would be super appreciated. Words are important. We're trying to be specific, direct about what it is we are saying. Racists will use those metaphors to practice deception. Victims of racism, frequently we don't have all the information, still learning. We don't have all of the info. So sometimes we will substitute an analogy, metaphor of some sort, as opposed to sharing logic, evidence. If we could be specific, precise with what it is we would like to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Again, if you could take 5 minutes and please use your mute button if you know you are in a loud environment or might be coughing or any other than silent, just use your mute button so we don't have all that extra background noise. Much obliged. If that parent or parents are here and you got it, I mean, perfect. Your offspring doesn't have white friends. They're writing a code book in Braille. If that parent exists, please make sure you are on speed dial. We can get you first. We might not need to hear any other callers. If that person is not here, we'll just get to the rest of us confused victims. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. Unfortunately, I don't have all the answers as an attempted parent. And I'm definitely glad, really appreciative that you played that clip with Ms. Smith and her son, because it at least shows that she wasn't just fully willing to allow him to go over to the boy's house, and then hopefully, unfortunately, he'll be able, the young black male, he'll be able to learn from that situation, that sometimes it could just be the one white person who's supposed to be your quote unquote friend that will bring around or be somehow connected or affiliated with the racist white people who are more openly racist. The only other comment that I'll make, I'll keep it real short. I drove my grandmother to get her vaccine shot, and it was like a drive-through situation. And there was a lot of cars. I think I could only maybe judge about 50 or so, but then I couldn't see all of them because the line was so long. And at first I wasn't really paying attention to the other people in the car, in the other cars, but I eventually started paying attention to them, and the majority of them, let's say if I saw 50 cars, the majority of them were white people. So including myself, I think I only saw five people who would be classified, or five cars with people who would be classified as black. And then I was also taking account of like who was actually working, giving out the shots. She did get the two shot. I think it was the Pfizer one. She was pretty excited about it. And most of the people who were working were also white. There was only, actually, I'm sorry, one of the other people who were getting the vaccination, they would be classified as quote-unquote Asian, non-white, non-black. There was only one quote-unquote Asian person who actually, she administered the shot to my, no, sorry, she asked questions. There was like this whole questionnaire that had to be asked before you got the shot, and it was actually a white man who gave my grandmother the shot. He was a firefighter, if I'm not mistaken, but that was the main people who were actually giving out the shots. It was like a 2-inch long needle. It was crazy. So I feel like, I don't know if my views are kind of changing about the shot, because it's very interesting that all of those, so many different white people were in line to get the shot, and there were so few black people. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Right on. Did your grandmother get the second? She just got the first shot, and then she has to go back to get the second one, or she already got the second one?
She just got the first one, and I will likely be taking her to get the second one. So I'll also give an update about that to who I see at that time.
Okay. Gotcha. That has been consistent with what has been reported, where they've said it's been more white people getting the vaccine, where the vaccine has been available more so in areas with more white people. And even they've had areas where some white people have reportedly been going and stealing, going into areas where it's more non-white people. And then they've had an influx of white people who are not even residents of that area going and getting the vaccine there. And then even from a global perspective, it's been mostly white dominated countries that are getting the vaccine, and then countries with mostly non-white people struggling to get access or not having access at all. They talked about the entire continent, so-called, of Africa being one of these folks where they're struggling trying to get access. But I said it would not surprise me at all if we get, you know, a year, 5 years later, and the racist narrative will be, yep, the vaccine was great. It did not have anything nefarious. Bill Gates was not behind it. And the niggers didn't take it because they all ran around talking about Nurse Rivers. That would not surprise me at all if that's what happens. We end up getting there. And it was not that black people were scared and they were talking about Tuskegee and all that. White people promoted that. But it was, they didn't even have access. It wasn't even in the area where they could go get it and what have you. Like, anywho, we will see. Please let us know. Give us the update. And the other, we've had other people too who've, you know, gotten the shot or what have you. Give us the update. Let us know what the experience was like, how you feel, all the rest of it about that experience. And one truthful parent, still learning. If we got that perfect parent out there, make sure you get your hand up, *61. Other folks who have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Oh, retired firefighter in Florida. Another parent. Let's see.
My offspring, to my knowledge, because when he was a younger fella, his mom shared time with me in supervising him as a parent, but never was the subject of him sleeping over, quote unquote, with white people was ever even verbalized. I had an experience as a quote unquote minor back in the 1970s. I think I was about 17 years old, and they had a party at a white person's house after a spring football game, to whereas they were serving alcohol and everything else. So my understanding of white people is that the parents identify the quote-unquote children almost on an adult status. It's not an adult status. And there's a lot of wildness that goes on in a white household. So that was always in my mind, you know, when I became an attempted parent. Also, I would actually warn non-white black parents to be cautious about your child going to anybody's house. Talking about sleeping over. I mean, be very scoutful about who your child is going to without your direct supervision. COVID-19 shots. I stay in beautiful Miami Gardens, which has a capacity of about 80% non-white black people. I went to the drugstore just to get things that you get from the drugstore. I can't remember what item it was, but it had nothing to do with COVID-19. And normally when I go somewhere to get something, I, prior to going to that place, know almost exactly what I'm going there for. I don't shop. And so basically it was a young non-white black female that was sitting at a desk. And she said something looked like it was directed towards me, but because I was dutiful and what I was in there for, kind of like just walked past and went to get what I was going to get. But I noticed, wait a minute. There's a whole lot of white people in this place. It's something unusual here. And I didn't think about it until I got home to realize what these white people were doing. They purposely were coming from places in northern Florida, central Florida, to get the shots, to get the shots in this highly popularized black area. Including a law enforcement official from somewhere in Palm Beach somewhere that showed up. I mean, and she was in uniform with her patrol car. DCS program, I did not attend today. What they do on this last session, of this period of time with these group of guys is they have, I think I mentioned a dinner as though it's some sort of business type of situation going on to prep young black males on the probability that they may have some sort of lifestyle where they have to, go to a dinner, quote unquote party or some kind of dinnerized meeting, where you're eating and whatnot, and some of those different rules about etiquette, quote unquote. What I went to was a funeral. I guess I'm getting at the age, whereas class reunions are becoming substituted for funerals. There is a crazy person by the name of Gus T. Renegade that mentions about the importance of health. And eating correctly, you want to, everybody is going to one day stop breathing, is going to have a death day, but you want to extend that. You want to extend that particular period of time as much as possible. There's a lot of work to continue to do. And of course, we need healthy people to be able to solve the problem of racism and white supremacy. The retired firefighter is working at that, attempting to. Sometimes I do fail. last but not least, just wanted to give a condolences to the great Marvin Hagler. And he was, I mean, yes, I do watch boxing. And he was one of the best. I did think, though, he did retire, and I never noticed if it is true. I don't know if it's true or not, but I never noticed that he had any signs of CTE. I've recently heard him speak, and it didn't sound like that slur that people that has that with the fighters, especially. That has anything like that. So, but they haven't really, not that I've read, on actually what was his demise or anything like that. But anyway, rest in peace. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
The great Marvin Hagler. Indeed. Health is important, for sure. We should, in fact, the book, we mentioned it some weeks back, You Are What Your Grandparents Ate, What You Need to Know About Nutrition, Experience, Epigenetics, and the Origins of Chronic Disease. Judith Finlayson, she should be on the program. Her book talks about obesity that came up last week, and the impact of foods, and not just the foods that you eat, but foods that your parents, grandparents eat, and how that can impact obesity. 139. Yep. Right there. I was reading that, getting prepared. Anyway, and the vaccine. Florida is one of the locations. One of the news reports they were talking about. They didn't say white people. They said wealthier people, privileged people, were leaving California and other regions where they're trying to make it more restricted in terms of only older people or really sick people or whatever it is, where it's more difficult to get access to the vaccine, in states where it's not as restricted. Some of these people were leaving and going to these regions. As I said, they had different reports in New York where they would have vaccine access in, like retired firefighter said, areas where it's a lot of non-white people. And then they would get all these appointments from people who don't even live in the state where they came in, probably white people. So like I said, it would not surprise me at all 5 years later, or when they do the great COVID retrospective, if it's, wow, the Negroes, they just weren't getting vaccinated. They ran around Nurse Rivers, Tuskegee this, and just wouldn't get the vaccine. When it was, nope, white people just hoarded it all and then blamed black people for being dumb and ignorant. Heard that type of thing before. Maybe not, but we shall see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed. I guess we still don't have our perfect parent yet either. Can't say that I'm surprised, but if they are out there, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have if we have that perfect parent, definitely do not wait. You should have been, on the line already. We have other folks. If they have thoughts, questions, observations, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Let's see. Last week, I was thinking about how I didn't answer the direct question about the Capitol riots, about are they going to prosecute the people. I don't think they're going to prosecute the majority of them, because, like you mentioned, that there were thousands of them, and they have all of this footage, and they still seem to be slow on the process of having charges filed against them. And there was a white man, I can't remember what his name was. He was on a radio show or something like that, where he said he admitted to his racism, I think. He said, hey, you know, if this were Black Lives Matter protesters or Antifa, I think that's also racist to try to bring that in. No, just strictly just focus on the Black people. He said, I would have had concern. So he said that people became outraged and said that that was racist. But I'm like, that's it. Like, he's admitting it. You know, I couldn't remember who some kind of politician. I couldn't remember his name, but it was a news report on that. So-called Republican. So I saw that report. And as far as the royal family, I did notice that as well. And it looked like Meghan Markle, it looked like she wanted to share even more, but still, like, the system of white supremacy, it looks like she had to put a limit onto it. And he still was being white as well, like you mentioned. Hey, you know, I'm not gonna divulge or whatever the term he used. I'm not gonna share much on that conversation. And just how the report said that they're gonna deal with the matter privately. Like, that's what they do anyways. So what are they talking about? Like, they already are private with the racism. So I don't know who might have made the comment about the dark skin or whatever. But when you look at the victim, she's very, you know, light in complexion. And the racism still, just in that area over there, they were still meticulous on their ability to tell that she's not white. So I found that very interesting through the week. And the last thing I want to end on is the anti-Asian I guess stories or whatever, the incidents or attacks. You know, I'm thinking people who classified as Asian, it seems like, are people who are living in proximity to people who classify themselves as white. And they showed an incident where it looks like it was a lighter complected female, but she was in the Uber, I guess, with two Black females. And she was coughing on this guy who they classified as Asian American. So it looked like they tried to use that. And I think that they were trying to practice some anti-Blackness, trying to say, in my opinion, that her behavior is influenced being around Black people or whatever. But the Black females weren't necessarily doing anything physical to the guy in that video. My last two, I was thinking about the Daniel Holzklaw. I think that's a guy who is classified as an Asian, Asian American, and how he was charged. I couldn't remember what the charges were for mistreating Black females. And there were people trying to say that the victims were lying and they're prostitutes, stuff like that. They didn't have that report on the news as much because both groups are mistreated as non-white victims of white supremacy. But just looking at the comparisons, and if one last thing is the young guy that was named Elliot Roger, I think. What's the term? The manifesto or whatever it is. He was talking about how the Black males, you know, was getting the sexual attention. You know, I can't get with these blonde females. You know, I'm a descendant from British, speaking of the term British aristocracy, and these are slaves. If y'all remember that. So, you know, where's that same concern for Black people? But of course, as the slogan goes, Black to the back. So, you know, I was thinking about those situations, and that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida, Elliot Roger, 2014. Lawrence Otis Graham Sr., he wrote that report. He did in the manifesto, Elliot Roger. And I think it was online. He had posted, he wrote like social media commentary where he was showing his anti-black feelings. Elliot Roger with a white parent and a non-white parent. Now, Daniel Holtzclaw, we talked about him, convicted rapist Daniel Holtzclaw in Oklahoma. There was confusion, talk about racial classification confusion, about his racial classification. I think he has one white parent, one non-white parent. People can look at his photo online. He played football in Michigan in college. In court, it was said on the witness stand that he was white. I remember this was a big point of contention. I know we do not have consensus among Cal's list, or at least people who were with us when we talked about this case. He was arrested in 2004 or arrested and charged in 2014, and then he was convicted at the end of 2015. But we talked about this, and I know some people, he said in court, we went through we paid attention to the trial and everything, like George Floyd and all that, and that did come up in court. What is his racial classification? And they said during the trial, he was classified as white. That didn't suffice for some people. Some folks looked at him and said, hey, I don't think he would be accepted as a white person. So people have to go in and look online. Call in Florida said this is a non-white, so-called Asian male. Some people, some Cal's listeners, that was their conclusion as well. They think he's a non-white male, so-called Asian. Was said in court he was white. You have to check online. Daniel Holtzclaw. You should see lots of reports. Convicted rapist, and as we proceed, I guess if people who remember, we talked about all of this. If you recall the case, you remember what he looks like, or take a look if you need to jog your memory, as they say, to see what he looks like, and you can share with us. White person, non-white person, let us know. We have about 10 minutes left in the broadcast. Will nab other folks with a hand up. Much obliged, caller. Did you say, you said in the report of the so-called anti-Asian violence, they were trying to make it seem like it was the association with these black folks is what I guess led to this wayward behavior and coughing on this victim?
Like the way they had structured the report, they showed apparently this person has a I don't think she's classified as black. She was lighter complected, and she was the one being more hostile toward the driver. And it was two other females in the back sitting alongside her who looked like they would be classified as black. And then they showed footage from her Instagram, and they showed her way of speaking and everything. And I think people would associate that with black people and playing hip hop music and stuff like that. So I think the news report, they was trying to imply that her association with those two black people is the reason why, you know what I mean? Where she would conduct herself in that way. I think, in my opinion, that's what they were trying to insinuate with that report.
I gotcha. That is common. We've talked about that, workplace racism, that sort of thing. But even if it's not even if the person is not classified as black per se, sometimes it might just be as simple as they'll have them in a photo where they're wearing black, and that might be enough. But I mean, it sounds like they went extreme with, oh yeah, look at them. They got all kinds of Drake songs and the rest of it on their social media, and they're actually hanging out with black people and all the like, oh yeah, total nigger by associate, honorary niggers. Before I nab some of the other folks who dialed in, I just want to say we did just read about a famous murder trial. Talking about George Floyd, I noticed a lot of similarities, but they were talking about jury selection. I think they're halfway through. We would have talked a lot more about that if it had been any other week. I didn't hear anybody say, because this was said during the Simpson book, I didn't hear anybody say that, oh man, if I'm a black person, if I go back to the black community and we don't have a guilty verdict, oh man, I will never be able to show my face the scorn and ridicule and hatred. Like, I might have to move out of Minnesota. I didn't hear anybody say that. I haven't seen any of those reports that black people in Minnesota or black people, you know, in America, so-called, are so powerful that a black person, you get on there and you don't get that correct verdict. Man, we are coming after you, brother, sister. If you hear that, let me know. But that was suggested in the O.J. Simpson book. Other folks that we missed totally.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Gus. If Holtzclaw is the Joker that was like sitting in the car recording the video before he went on his thing, if I remember correctly, I would guess that white people would probably determine him as not white. When it comes down to it, when it really gets down to the nitty gritty, perfect parenting. I have a non-white daughter who's 7 years old and divorced from her non-white black mother. And I would say that to combat that, the entire kind of inclusion, interfaith, like getting into hanging out with white kids and being blind to the dangers therein, I would say that that's a constant work for me. From 0 to 7 years, it has been a constant deconstructing of all the instruction and just kind of framing for how to approach hanging out with kids and school and teachers and what racism, white supremacy has to do with all that. So I there's no perfect model, but I say those 0 to 7 years are so crucial. And just instructing the child and just having loads and loads and loads of representation so that the child can see themselves in powerful kind of imagery, et cetera, et cetera. And here in Austin, the COVID vaccine is just anecdotally, a white woman I work with was telling us all kind of small kind bragging about how they went to Dove Springs, which is on the east side and is mostly black, low-income kind of community. And she was saying, yeah, it's all white people. They're lined up in their cars getting the vaccines. So it's happening here. Lastly, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, rest in peace. And by the way, he was the genius. His trainers in Massachusetts never trained another champion, similar to I think Angelo Dundee and Ali, maybe Dundee had another champion, but anyway, the genius was in Hagler. So rest in peace to that brother.
Marvin Hagler. That's two people who said, I told you we didn't have agreement. That's two people though. Maybe I was the only one who thought Holtzclaw was white. Although I do remember at least there being some other folks. They said it in the trial. They said it in the trial. That's two people who think Holtzclaw is a non-white person. Probably were others. I remember there were others too. Much about another non-white person saying they were not a perfect parent. No surprise there. But those first 7 years are super important, critical, and just speak honestly. Speak honestly. Let's see. Other folks, much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Let's see. Vaccine, so consistent. Heard the same thing. Heard that from multiple different people in different geographic locations. And that corresponds exactly to some of the reports that we've heard. Other folks with a hand up.
May I be heard?
Mr. Blue. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Woody Allen. I remember when all this was happening in New York City. I am 50 plus, and so when it was happening, this was not the start of people classify themselves as white adopting non-white children, but it was one of those cases where it started to expose more and more, especially white actors and actresses starting to adopt non-white children from all over the world, and particularly non-white countries. And I think I might have seen the documentary, but I do know that I saw like different reports all during that time where his spouse, Mia Farrow, had made allegations that he'd been touching the children, their other children, and committing acts of sexual violence against them, but no one would believe her. But I don't know if you could tell me the name of that documentary, I'd appreciate that. But and now it's even more prevalent because there's the actress Charlize Theron, who's been in many movies, and she played in Monster and in other things. And she has adopted two non-white black boys, and she lets her black boys dress as girls and affect themselves as girls at ages that are well below, like, even prepubescent age. They may be in their early, you know, very early elementary to junior high school ages, and she's allowed them, with a conversation about gender, to dress like girls. And there's been many more white actors and actresses who adopted non-white children. And I believe that we'd probably be hearing many more cases of sexual misconduct against these children. But I think, just like with the Woody Allen case, that those allegations and things like that will be hidden from the mainstream population and mainstream media. That young boy in Plano, Texas, going through that, I've had my parents, being non-white, black, from the South, victims, always learning, doing the best that they could as parents. They suggested that we do hang out with white children. And I can tell you from my experience growing up and being around white children that white parents give their white children a lot of leeway. It was the first time that I ever heard cursing or swearing in the house. It was when I visited my so-called white friends during elementary and junior high school and high school years, where they would curse in the house freely. Alcohol could be freely accessed by them. Any types of pills or marijuana. And the parents always knew that the children were doing something, but they were never scolded the way that we would be scolded in my house if we ever swore or cursed or did anything inappropriate in the non-white black household, in opposition to the white household, where their children were given free rein to do a lot of things. And my experience as a younger child in Rochester, in the suburbs of Rochester, through the Fresh Air Fund, this program where a white family would choose a black child to spend the summer with them, I learned at the ages of 9, 10, 11, 12, how the white children could turn on you. And eventually they started using the N-word towards me because they thought that I was not following their rules or had upset them in some way, and I never returned. And that was my first experience with full-on true racism and white supremacy from children. We weren't even prepubescent yet. With what's going on in the Asian community, we've been listening, and I've been looking at a lot of reports and news reports, and once again, always trying to turn it around and focus and say or accuse black people of committing these crimes, when the reports that I've been reading it's been Asian people, from Thai people, Koreans, Chinese, Japanese, in their communities, being assaulted by what it seems to be people who classify themselves as white. But the reports never say that it's white people, white men, primarily white men, young white men. They never say that. It's just always young male accosted, assaulted, and Asian, and particularly an older Asian person. So that's been going on a lot. And I appreciate that the segment with Harriet Washington because a lot of non-white black people that I've been talking to about the vaccine, they have their skepticism and, you know, they're not trusting of it, which makes perfect sense based on the history of medical apartheid here in America and abroad globally. But, you know, the Tuskegee experiment, that's just one. But if we can come to contemporary America and contemporary times, we can talk about Detroit and one of the segment that talked about Mississippi losing power with Texas and other southern states that got the snowfall and started losing power, no water. Jackson, Mississippi, right there, not being able to, not even having water to boil water. Is yet again one of those instances that I see where racism is being practiced against a particular black community within the larger community. I hope everyone stays safe. Thank you, Gus. Thank you, callers. Everyone have a good night, and please be safe. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Blue, with us down in Florida for the retreat. Seems like 50 years ago was just basically a year ago. The documentary is Alan V, like versus Pharaoh. And it's a 4-part series. I think it's on HBO. I don't think you have to have HBO to watch it, but that's, you know, the production of it at all. But it's a 4-part series, and I think the fourth and final installment is like Monday or maybe Sunday, sometime within the next like 48 hours. I think the final installment should air, but the first three are already available. Wow, it is fascinating. And it gets into the detail about what you talked about, the adoptions and all of that, and all of these non-white children. Where did they come from? What was the impetus for this? And Yeah, allegations of him molesting many of these children and all of that. And yeah, it's white people do not care about children. They show him at the Knicks games and all the rest of it as this is coming up. Woo, I bet during the whole O.J. Simpson debacle, Woody Allen was probably hanging out right there. Like they always do the, like they'll pan the crowd, right? And show all the celebrities and such that are at the Knicks games. So at the finals, right, with the O.J. Simpson and the Jeep thing, like this is the NBA finals. So, I mean, everybody is at the Knicks game five. Was it game five? Yeah, I think it was game five for the Knicks. So, I mean, I am very sure if you go back and watch that footage, old child raping Woody Allen is front and center, MSG. Patrick Ewing better have a passport, identification, lunch card, anything else to get in. Woody Allen, we'll usher you right to the front, sir. Spike Lee, get out of here, Spike Lee. You better have identification, too. Make sure you come through the correct door, the back door.
Thank you, Gus. Thank you. And I believe Charles Oakley was also he was also expunged from the stadium at some point. It's ridiculous. Thank you, Gus.
Racism, white supremacy. Racism, white supremacy.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I found the movie that you mentioned with Ali, Malcolm, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown to be constructive. And it was strange. The same thing started happening to me right after the movie. I started being inundated with stuff about Muhammad Ali, including an interview I watched with the guy who played Raj on What's Happening, talking about his experiences with Mr. Ali. Woody Allen and his abducted daughter turned white. This is why I disagree with white people adopting black people. This is the type of stuff that could end up happening. How long was that going on? But the Madison Square Garden Staples, the Trinity of the 1990s Knicks basketball, Oakley Ewing and Spike Lee, all have been mistreated by James Dolan, and it's not positioned in that way. He's the culprit he's the most powerful white person and the common denominator between all of them. And he's a racist, you know. Black people who perform random acts of racism or violence, black people who perform random acts of violence against Asians here in New York are being charged with hate crimes. One black guy punched an Asian man in the face, total random crime. He looked like he was just walking down the street and saw someone and just punched him. So they got his picture up in the train station with hate crime next to it. Another man this week, he punched an Asian man in the face, and they put his picture up on the subway, and next to it says hate crimes. And neither one of these people talked to the Asians, so I didn't hear them call them a kook or whatever, chink or whatever, before they threw the punch. So it seems like they're charging these people with hate crimes. NY1 just did an investigation on this news channel where they, reported on these instances against Asians. And the way the whole thing was done, it was, a bunch of black people apologizing. It was very, very odd. Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head getting banned. You can't use gender descriptive words in Congress. So you can't say congressman or woman anymore, boy, girl, son, daughter, sister, brother, mother, father, uncle, aunt, or any other gender descriptive words. They have been banned. They did a prayer at the House of Representatives a few weeks ago, and the minister at the end said, amen and a woman. And I said, wow. So this is going deeper, and it's very confusing. And now they're allowing male-born athletes who identify as female to compete against the female athletes. And I see a consortium of feminists who are for this. And I'm like, wow, you fought so hard to get gender equality in sports, especially in college. And then you turn around and in less than a generation, you guys want to let the men compete against them. So it's very interesting. The COVID, which was novel, meaning new, unlike the flu and common cold, it affects black people disproportionately, as they reported, disproportionately to white people. So they want us to take the same vaccinations. You know, it seems, the clip about the mistrust of the COVID vaccination, they had a black man explain why he thinks black people are reluctant to take these shots to a white reporter, using the Tuskegee experiment as the reasoning. I believe that was white propaganda. They even had clips of Harriet Washington, who wrote the medical apartheid book, as we all know. And in her book, she mentioned how blacks are given different types of hemoglobin when they get into trauma centers, how black bodies were dug up from the graveyards. It's a whole bunch of disproportionate things that was only done to black people. And this week, Wendy Williams was asked by Dr. Oz, might have not been this week, but I saw the clip this week. She was asked by Dr. Oz, would she be taking the vaccine? She was reluctant to ask. He started pressing her, and finally she answered, saying, I don't trust it. And my question is, do black people need to explain a reason not to trust white people or white government? It's like the question we ask whites on the cows. Would it be correct for black people to suspect all white people are racist? And that's the way I look at that. And I had other things to add, but I know we're running slow on time. Oh, lastly, the Meghan Markle, when it came to asking who said what, the white code popped in, no snitching. And is anyone surprised that these actions of the British, they conquered the world, they got people speaking English on every continent that's habitable, even in Chinese, in Hong Kong and Shanghai? I don't understand what if anyone expected her to go there and be treated just like they treat their own people. To ask for the princess and duchess, before she was engaged to the prince, she was an actress, and in an interview when she was asked if she identified as black, she said no, she identifies as racially ambiguous.
Oh, did you mute your? I guess he muted his line. I was, I chuckled there because that's how I identify her, as racially ambiguous. That's not a racial classification. She's just non-white. But that was what I said when I saw her. I didn't say, oh, Prince Harry is marrying a black female, because I didn't know who she was when I heard it. I was, oh, she's racially ambiguous. Like, right on. We have consensus there. That is interesting because they said that with the person I mentioned, Antoine Watson, who's being charged. They said he barreled into this non-white male, Asian male, but he was not in a car. He was just running across the street. They said they wanted him charged with a hate crime. But as I said in the video, and I think the prosecuting attorney, he said the same thing. Like, you couldn't really, there wasn't any evidence of him, you know, calling him names or something like that. And in the video that they presented, you couldn't hear anything. So he said it wasn't really clear what happened here in terms of, you know, a hate crime or something of that. But they were saying that he has not been charged with a hate crime. Antoine Watson, I'm talking about. Anywho, we will be here on Wednesday to discuss the Meghan Markle, Prince Harry tackiness, I guess you want to call it. I will do my best to see if I can get the audio of Dr. Welsing talking about Princess Diana and these same concerns being addressed in the 90s. I thought it was interesting when I heard it before. I just didn't make a note. I generally am not listening to take notes and write down exactly what is being talked about in every audio segment, although maybe that should be done. But I will see if I can locate it, because that would be awesome to have in context for the broadcast on Wednesday. But Renithia Tate, she's been with us before, Pieces of a Puzzle. You can go back and hear what she had to say in 2018 when the marriage took place. Royal fantasy. We talked about all of this and her projections, although, I mean, the metaphor, it's not rocket science to see that this sort of thing would happen. But we'll talk about that in detail Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward. Much obliged to all the folks who participated. I guess if the perfect parent is with us and you did not get a hand up, you definitely can't be a spectator if you're a perfect parent. Try to be empathetic with other victims of racism. I think that will help us get a little bit closer to solving this problem. There is never any justification for a non-white person being mistreated, and I suspect all non-white people are still learning as it relates to racism, white supremacy. So I guess we can keep that in mind as well. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need a fully functioning brain computer. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. I would still hunker down. It is super, super dangerous out and about for many, many reasons. Do as much as you can to hunker down. Stay safe. If you're out and you see someone being hostile, man, exit. It is not a time for verbal confrontations with strangers. If you see somebody being rowdy, you should be thinking that they could be armed. In fact, they might even be with others who are armed and ready to harm. Minimize contact. Get out of there. If you are going out sober, vigilant, driver or passenger, you are buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things that we can to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. And we need all of our attention so we can be mindful about what's happening around us. With that, Creator, help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. Help us to be patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, no brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.